Okay, well, welcome to this session, U.S. Climate and Weather Extremes, Past, Present, and Future. This session has been organized by the U.S. National Committee for Quaternary Science, brochure here, and also co-sponsored by the U.S. National Committees for Geodesy and Geophysics, Geological Sciences, and Soil Sciences. A couple of housekeeping things of the National Academy of Sciences. A couple of housekeeping things. One of them, you would see in the front tables, the round tables, plenty of materials. Those are reports or reports in brief originated from reports published by the National Academy of Sciences. You are welcome to take any of the materials that you see. And the other housekeeping thing is that on the chairs, you will see surveys. They are very short, will take a minute or so to complete, but it will inform our choices of sessions for the coming years. Thank you very much, and I'll pass it on to Connie Woodhouse.
Yeah, again, thank you for joining our session. Our session is on U.S. Climate and weather extremes, past, present, and future. Extremes of a wide variety of timescales have been in the news. We've just had a blizzard here in Boston last week, which is a pretty extreme event, although not unprecedented. There's been heat waves recently. There have been persistent droughts. All of these extremes have been in the news. And one of the questions that people are asking is this climate change or is this part of the natural variability of the system? And so this session is designed to explore the nature of extremes in climate and weather. And we're looking at it both from the perspective of the long term, the paleoclimatic record, current events, and some projections for the future. We're also going to be having a couple speakers talk about impacts, both socioeconomic impacts and ecological impacts, and then, of course, the role of the media. So we'll have six speakers who will each speak for 20 minutes each. We'll have a discussant. Kathy Jacobs will do a discussion for 15 minutes at the end, and then we'll have 15 minutes open for questions. The speakers have a minute or two for a question as well, so if they keep to their time, we'll have a time for just a question or two right after their talks. Otherwise, hold those questions till the end. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the first speaker, who is Don Wubbles from the University of Illinois, and his talk is Severe Weather in the United States Under a Changing Climate.
Thank you. So what I'm going to do today is just give you a quick overview of some of the scientific understanding about severe weather and a changing climate. As part of the preparations for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, we held four workshops that looked at severe weather and our understanding of those processes and how they relate to climate. And out of that workshop, we developed this graphic, or this series of workshops, we developed this graphic that basically says that looks at, you know, how well do we detect changes that are occurring? You know, do we have adequate measurements? And then look at that versus how well do we understand the causes? How well do we understand what's going on and how it relates to what's changing the climate? And some things we know very well. And that's probably, you know, primary areas we're going to talk about today, precipitation and heat waves, cold waves, floods and droughts, and extratropical cyclones. But other things, like hail and tornadoes, you know, we just don't have sufficient data to really be able to give a clear message. So I'm going to concentrate on those things that we have some understanding about, sufficient understanding about, to be able to tell you kind of where we're at. And we're going to look particularly at extreme temperatures, heat and cold waves, extreme precipitation, floods and droughts, and a little bit on extreme storms. Well, if we look at the temperature record and its change over time, there's several ways in which we might see extreme temperature looking globally or nationally. And you might expect that there might be several ways that could occur. One is through an increase in the mean temperature, you know, some more hot days, less cold days. Another way is a change in the variance. And then finally, both of those happening, and so you can get, because of changes in the variance, you could get more cold extremes as well as more hot extremes. Well, we're obviously being dominated by what is occurring in terms of getting more warmer temperatures, and there may be some change in the variance, although there's certainly a lot more uncertainty in that. This is an analysis done by the NASA Goddard Institute of Space Studies by Jim Hansen and people there, and basically says if we look at the changes in temperature globally relative to the 1951 to 1980 period, that we certainly have seen a large shift to the right with more warm temperatures. That's further shown by this graphic, which is very complicated looking, but not so bad if you just quickly understand. The top three graphs are the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, showing the relatively small amount of large-scale 2 sigma, 3 sigma type events, the 95th and 99th percentile of large temperatures. And you compare with that, we look at the last decade, which is the next 9 graphs, 2003 to 2011, and basically you're seeing a lot more of these red and brown temperatures globally, indicating we're seeing a lot more very large temperature swings than particularly in warm temperatures than we have seen before. So that's one indicator. Going to the national level, the U.S. level, the NOAA National Climate Data Center has totally reanalyzed all the climate data for the U.S. and in the process has given us a lot more confidence in the changes we're seeing in the U.S. I'm not going to just show you the average changes. We're certainly seeing an increase in temperature across the U.S. What I'm going to concentrate more on are the extreme events. One such indicator of that is to look at how many heat records are we setting versus cold records. If we go back to the 1950s, you see the situation you would normally expect if there wasn't a major change in climate occurring, where you get about equal, roughly the same number of cold events and heat events. What we're seeing in the decade of the 2000s is 2-to-1 ratio in terms of heat records being set versus cold records. And if we turn to 2011, it was 3-to-1, and this last year it was closer to 10-to-1. So, not to say what's going to happen exactly this decade, but we're certainly tending to see an overall increase in the number of heat records being set in the U.S. This is kind of a complicated graph that looks at the trend in heat waves and cold waves, particularly looking at 4-day events. The red bars are the decadal changes in heat waves, and the blue are the decadal changes in cold waves. And basically across the U.S. as a whole, we're seeing a net increase in the number of heat waves over the last 5 decades. The heat waves of the 1930s still kind of dominate in terms of, which were over a few-year time period, still kind of dominate in terms of looking at these kind of 4-day events. But nonetheless, we're still seeing a significant increase occurring. And at the same time, throughout the U.S., we're tending to see less cold waves occurring. Particularly if we look at the western part of the U.S., we're seeing a significant increase in heat waves and also the Northeast, not so much in the Midwest where I live. Now, if we turn to precipitation, we're generally seeing more likelihood for extreme precipitation, but also an increased likelihood for drought. If we look at the increasing trend and just precipitation, overall the U.S. is seeing a net increase, as indicated by the map. The decadal changes are shown with all those bar graphs. So generally, the U.S. is seeing an increase in precipitation, but it's not occurring everywhere, particularly seeing more in the Northeast and Midwest and less so in the Southwest, more tendency towards a decrease in the Southwest. However, in all parts of the U.S. and in most parts of the world, we're seeing that more of the precipitation, when it comes, is coming as larger events. This isn't surprising in that as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor. It's kind of basic physics. And if we look at the top 1% of the events historically and look at the trends over the last 50 years, we've seen a very significant increase in the Midwest and the Northeast, a 45% increase in this top 1% events in the Midwest, and a 74% increase in the East. As I said, all parts of the nation are seeing an increase in precipitation coming as larger events. This graph looks at two-day events and what are called, in blue, the one-year storms, red, the five-year storms, and the green, the 20-year storms. And in all cases, over the last 50 years, we're seeing an increase in the likelihood for such events. In the Midwest, the 1 in 20-year event is now become more like the 13-year event. Very significant increase. The graph on the left is messed up, but basically what it tells you is that it's from a report done by the USGS in 2011, and basically says that we're seeing a net increase in floods in the Northeast and the Midwest. Not surprising, this is we're getting more precipitation and more precipitation coming as large events in that part of the world, and a decrease in floods in the Southwest. In other parts of the country, you don't have clear messages. If we look at droughts over a similar time period, we're seeing a tendency towards more droughts, particularly in the West and in the Southwest. Not so much in the Midwest, where we actually had a very large drought this past year. Nonetheless, that analysis of drought was based on the Palmer Hydrological Index, which is perhaps not the best measure of drought. And I'll show you some projections, actually, that suggest drought will likely increase dramatically over the coming decades in the U.S. But I think it's very questionable because the Palmer Index just is not sufficient because it doesn't adequately account for soil moisture. And if we look at the short-term changes in drought across the U.S., there's a tendency for an increase. However, if you look at the long-term trends, it's not so clear. And so generally, the conclusion of the community right now is that, well, we're not really seeing that much of an overall change in drought for the entire country. One thing we are seeing, though, is that over the last 32 years, when NOAA has been analyzing the billion-dollar disaster events in the U.S., that we've been seeing an increase in such events, with 2011 and 2012. 2012 isn't shown on here. Seeing a very significant increase in the number of such events, 14 in 2011, 11 in 2012, and both years having over $60 billion in damage. So these are due to heat waves, cold waves, floods, droughts, major storms, tornadoes, hurricanes, and other things, wildfires, that are all affecting the U.S. that are all weather-related. But generally, we're seeing this increasing trend, and it's costing the country a great deal of money. Looking at those type of events, and some of them we can analyze and some of them we can't, there is a detectable human influence in the analysis on looking at a number of major events. These are very complex studies, so not most weather events have still not been analyzed. But we do know that some things like the European heat wave in 2003 that killed out many thousands of people, or the Moscow heat wave in 2010, and the 2011 drought and heat wave in Texas and Oklahoma clearly are more likely because of the fact of the human influence on climate. For example, in the bulletin of the American Meteorological Society from this last year, a paper discussed the 2011 drought in Texas and Oklahoma as having a 20 more, 20 times more likelihood as being related to human activities because of the changes in climate. 20 times more likely to have occurred because of the changes in climate that have occurred because of human activities. Other analysis suggested a smaller increase, maybe 2 to 3 times, but nonetheless still a great increase in the likelihood for such an event because of the fact that we've changed the background atmosphere. Now, if we look at projections of the future, overall, we can expect the most likely cases. Right now, we're basically following the very highest case here. There's two sets of scenarios. One basically what was used in the last international assessment, and the other, the RCP scenarios being used in the current assessments. But the highest scenarios basically all assume that we continue heavy use of fossil fuels. The lowest scenarios assume that we fairly rapidly start changing away from fossil fuels to alternatives. But you can see that, you know, if we look at projections for the U.S., you know, we could see 11, 12 degree changes by the end of this century. Very, very significant effects. In terms of precipitation, the scenarios tend to give kind of a similar picture, and particularly if you look at the high scenario pathway on the right, in the Northeast and the Midwest, a tendency towards more precipitation, particularly in the winter and spring, less precipitation in the summer, and not an awful lot of change in the fall. And in all seasons, the Southwest tending to mostly decrease in terms of total precipitation. But more of that precipitation, when it comes, is likely to come, again, throughout the U.S., is likely to come as severe precipitation. This is the 1% events, again, looking out of the future from the best current models, and basically suggests that we're likely to see a further very significant increase in the likelihood for such events. I mentioned already the projections for drought. This is from a paper by Weiner et al. From a couple of years ago that suggests a very significant increase in the likelihood of droughts in the U.S. and Mexico over the coming decades, but it is limited by the fact that it's dependent on this Palmer Index that I mentioned. If we look at hurricanes, in the North Atlantic, particularly where we have better data than we do for the Pacific, we're seeing an increase in the intensity of such events. And if we look at the best modeling analysis we have right now, the suggestions are that we're likely to have a further increase in intensity in hurricanes in the future. So in conclusion, certain types of extreme events are becoming more common. These trends are likely to continue. All weather today is happening in the background of a changed climate. More precipitation is coming as larger events. Heat waves are generally increasing, will likely become longer and more severe. Cold waves are decreasing. We have an increased risk of floods in some regions, and droughts are increasing in some regions. And in both cases, we have strong multi-year and large variability. So I want to thank you, and I'll be happy to address any questions here. We've had so the question is, how much is the changes in sampling rates affected these trends? And of course, the analysis are very careful to make sure that that doesn't affect the analysis at all. But we've had pretty good measurements across the U.S. since roughly 1895 in terms of looking at temperature and precipitation. Certainly there have been changes in the sampling over the years and how many stations there are, et cetera, but the analysis are done to try to make sure that that doesn't have a significant impact on the kind of trends that I'm showing. Yes.
Whoops.
Right. So the smaller area you look at, the more likely you're to see large variations, of course. And so things like over the U.S. where the 1930s, which also had a human-related effect as part of what was going on there, certainly can stand out. So that is why we concentrate, you know, in the national climate assessment, we really kind of compare, well, what's happened the last 50 years with what was happening the 60 years before that, so that we can get a sense of, you know, what those long-term trends are. If you look out over the planet, though, you know, have those issues in the 1930s particularly, does not stand out. And we have very clear trends for what is happening. Now, if you want to turn towards looking at particular storms or particular events, the analysis of that start with the assumption that, of course, many of these events can occur naturally, but how they might have been affected by the fact that we have longer standing highs, for example, that might be affecting a drought situation because of the fact that you've changed the background atmosphere and so you have a shift in the jet stream, et cetera, that are all part of the analysis. So it's very carefully looked at. I do suggest, if you want to learn more about that particular question, in the National Climate Assessment, I led the preparation of a commonly asked questions chapter. It's in one of the appendices. And in that, we go into some depth into that particular question.
Time for one more short question.
Right here. Yeah, when I make the statement that the trends are likely to continue, that is based on our best analyses of the best models, and in some cases I was showing you analyses from the models. So, for example, when I said severe precipitation, that was all based on analysis from the CMIP 5 models, which are our best current set of model calculations done for the ongoing IPCC assessment. And similar statements about heat waves and cold waves and so forth are also all based off of modeling analysis as extensions. But we start out with how well did the models represent what we've been observing, and does that give us confidence in making a projection for the future? And that was all. It's all kind of hidden in a 20-minute talk. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning. So I'm the media guy on the panel. Sort of have a hybrid background of climate science and climate journalism. And one of the things that I've been specializing in over the past couple of years is coverage of extreme events and how they relate to climate change, and also just coverage of extreme weather events, even if they're just weather events. So a couple of trends that we've noticed at Climate Central and just looking at the broader media that you should be aware of in looking from different science perspectives. One is that climate change coverage used to be pretty distinct from weather coverage. Extreme weather is changing that pretty quickly in terms of mainstream news coverage of climate. It's become much more integrated, so you'll have a story on a heat wave, and at the end it'll be a climate scientist saying something like, we expect to see more of these events in the future, or this is made more likely by climate change. The opportunity with that is that I think people pay more attention to the extremes that are going on a daily basis or monthly basis than they do to what might happen in 2050 or 2100. I think that has no public salience whatsoever, as much as we like to think it does. There's complexity that comes with it. So covering extremes within a climate context means wrestling with more complexity. It means wrestling with the natural variability questions. And to some extent, you know, the human brain is a pattern recognition machine. And I think that the public and to some extent politicians are starting to connect the dots ahead of the scientists on some extremes that Don and others might be more cautious about. So as Don said, you know, all weather events are occurring against the background of a changed climate. To me, you know, and this was the Bloomberg Business Week cover right after Hurricane Sandy, you know, to me, as a weather geek since birth, you know, all weather seems suspicious now. We get a blizzard in the Northeast that dumps 40 inches of snow in less than 24 hours in Connecticut, and we think, wow, did that used to happen? How is that possible? And then we sort of wait a while for the climate study to come out. And a colleague at the Weather Channel, Stu Ostro, basically says, you know, if A and B, then C. If you have more heat going into the system and conditions are different than they were, that means that everything that follows must be different in some way. And he uses that to kind of try to relate to the meteorologists there who are more skeptical of climate change. My Marco Rubio moment. You know, this past 2 years, we've seen so many extreme events. We have the drought, and it's hard to find 2012 in Nebraska, but it's down there. A very extreme drought continuing. Nebraska still incredibly hard hit. We had the hottest year on record in the lower 48, which got a lot of people's attention, and that's some of our coverage at Climate Central. Just some of the records we set, you know, between the sea ice record, which I think surprised some sea ice specialists as well, because the conditions weren't necessarily ideal for melting that much ice. Globally, the warmest La Nina year again. And, you know, at Climate Central, we're a science communications, we're a science research and journalism organization, and if you look at the media coverage of climate, the background level kind of goes up and down with IPCC reports and with UN conferences. And what we're trying to do is create kind of a steady line in the middle of a drumbeat of coverage. Not activist-oriented coverage. We're not an advocacy organization, but just science-based coverage. So according to one poll, one study, which I don't quite agree with their analysis, you know, two of us at Climate Central wrote the most amount of climate stories of any journalism organization during the past year. I find that hard to believe, but I guess my keyboard does look like it's been quite a busy year. This is just a graphic, a different take on what Don said in terms of having more daily record highs than record lows. And I think that that is something that has a lot of public recognition, because people can relate to daily record highs. They can relate to the day, daily temperature that they see on the weather report and the changing ratio of that. You know, if you talk to climate scientists, well, you know, personally, the strangest events of the past year in the United States and the most clearly connected to climate, to me, from a reporting standpoint, was the March 2012 heat wave, which really resulted in an acceleration of the drought in the upper Midwest and kind of kicked that off into high gear, resulted from a huge blocking high over the eastern United States and that low just sitting there, unable to move anywhere over Texas. I think Texas actually got some rain out of that, so that was good for them. But you had temperatures in the 70s in March all the way to International Falls, Minnesota. And that location has the nickname of the icebox of the nation. And it didn't really live up to the name. There were just so many records that were falling that I could not keep up, that other meteorologists were just saying, I've never seen anything like this in the United States before. That's this wind visualization that's actually running live every day. If anybody has not seen that yet, the website's on the bottom right. It's just hint.fm/wind. And I think the people who did this are now working for Google. But those are the winds, the average winds during the March heat wave. And you can see the lines from the southeast blowing right up towards Chicago and into Wisconsin, and that spin over Texas with that low-pressure system. That's not the normal flow in the U.S. in March for 2 weeks in a row, or even 3 weeks. We saw this in Australia recently when they needed to put in a new color for their weather map, going up to 53 degrees C. This image doesn't actually show that new color, but it's kind of this weird purpley magenta color of death. And, you know, January is their summer, and they set their hottest month on record. So we set ours in July 2012, and they set theirs in their equivalent of July. This resulted from that. This was a family that was taking shelter in the water from wildfires that were coming right at them in Australia. They survived. And then a couple weeks later, Australia was hit with record floods. And we're seeing part of the extremes story isn't just talking about the extremes that occur and their climate context. It's also really getting across the point that regardless of the complexities of the connections between the extreme event and global warming, between the fractional attribution of an event and climate change, we are seeing more impacts, and we will see more impacts from even ordinary events. So your nor'easter that you just had in New England delivered a more fearsome coastal flooding punch now than it would have 30 years ago just because of the sea level rise. And, you know, what we tell people about Sandy is, you know, we certainly know that hurricanes can occur naturally. They can occur naturally all the way up to New England. They have. Scientists have been warning that they would again for many years. But the impacts of one hitting now are worse than what they would have been. This is a more simplistic version and probably too simplistic of what Don showed. And it's just looking at some of the extremes that we know more about versus the ones that we know less about. And, you know, reporting on heat waves and climate change, I think, is pretty intuitive. Reporting on coastal flooding and climate change is pretty intuitive. We have a whole sea level rise mapping project at Climate Central, so you can look down to your zip code, if you live on the coast, of what the impacts of climate change-related sea level rise may be for different storms in the future. And extreme events, and as you get down towards droughts, hurricanes, and tornadoes, there's less and less that's known. That doesn't always get through to the media. Popular Science ran a story that was actually incredibly well written but very poorly headlined called "Did Global Warming Destroy My Hometown?" about the Joplin tornado. And there were a lot of tornado researchers who were up in arms about that one. And to some extent, you know, I think the media, the broader media, mainstream media, has started focusing more and more on just the man-made component of climate change, ignoring natural variability. And there's a couple of dangers with that. One, it's not accurate. Two, it doesn't prepare the public well for a cold year or a cold decade that we know very well may occur due to natural variability, or a drought that's primarily kicked off by La Nina and sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic. And from a science writing perspective, natural variability is really interesting. Trying to figure out the connections between different cycles in the climate and what happens in the U.S. and the rest of the world is really interesting. Looking at the North Atlantic Oscillation in the wintertime and trying to explain that to people is strangely my idea of fun. So we've covered drought. You know, President Obama in the State of the Union address put drought in there among all the extremes that he lumped in as kind of global warming extremes. I sort of cringed a little bit because, you know, we're in this huge drought right now and there are climate change connections, but we look, at least my coverage has been at looking at drought, at climate change as the drought accelerant, not necessarily the main cause. Looking at climate change as the accomplice to a crime, not the shooter, or not the one who goes in and actually robs the bank, but the one who drove the getaway car. modifying the background conditions. And I just think there's lots of stories to be found in natural variability. Nobody, until we did this story, had looked at why all seasonal drought forecasts in the U.S. failed to predict the drought. And it turned out that there was actually modeling done at GFDL that correctly forecast the whole thing, but it was an outlier prediction. So in the broader science community, they decided not to use that for the official forecast. And I think there was modeling elsewhere that did that too. We're trying to tell some of those stories at Climate Central that we don't think the broader media is covering as well as they should be, but also really try to relate extreme events to the scientific underpinnings. And one of the ways that we're doing this is we're trying to get content to TV meteorologists, because for years it's been a problem that TV meteorologists don't cover climate change, that they're skeptical of climate. We found they're increasingly wanting to communicate on this. If you give them the resources and the tools and the analyses to do so, and some of the graphics to do so, really cool things can be accomplished. And the guy who won the AMS award for climate communication this past year is a TV meteorologist out of Columbia, South Carolina, who works with us. And South Carolina is a pretty red state. And, you know, he hasn't been knocked off the air by talking about climate change, which is encouraging for us and him. But graphics like this, in terms of looking at the ratios, when you're in the middle of a heat wave in your local market, that actually gives you an advantage over your rival station that doesn't have that graphic. I think, to some extent, reporters, hopefully, like me, are asking better questions now. You still get the question at press conferences and, you know, during an event where reporters will call you and say, did global warming cause this blizzard? And I'm sure you want to say, well, that's a stupid question. And I've had people say to me that exact thing, and I've learned how to change the question. But really, like Don said, it's about how global warming may have influenced the odds of an event, changed its characteristics, made it more severe than it otherwise would be, or just affected its impacts. And then just being mindful that events don't always conform with the broader narrative that extremes are global warming connected and that we're getting more extremes and then extremes, you know. The blizzard of 2013, other than the tremendous amount of moisture that it carried, putting down 4 inches of liquid precip in 24 hours, which I've never seen from a non-stalled out nor'easter, is pretty remarkable. But besides that, you know, it was a nor'easter. We see that. It looked like a nor'easter on satellite. It talked like a nor'easter. Like, you know, a lot of the climate change discussion I just thought was off base. The studies done on the Thailand floods, which actually, if you had ordered a PC or a laptop, at a certain point last year, you would have probably met with a delay because it disrupted the global supply chain because of all the chips that are manufactured in an area of Thailand that was flooded. That was blamed more on poor management than it was on extreme, than on the climate influence. And lastly, I want to say that, you know, as extremes move the media to cover climate change differently, I think they're moving the public even faster. You know, I think that some of the polling which shows that the majority of Americans view global warming as harmful to them now is very different than what the polling was a couple of years ago, where people saw it as a remote threat in time and in geography. And the public is connecting the dots in ways that don't necessarily conform to the scientific evidence, just in conversations I have with people about where they'll raise the crazy tornado season of 2011 and say, yeah, we're having all these tornadoes, that must be global warming. And I say, well, you know, he actually talks to the tornado researchers and they say that atmospheric wind shear may actually decrease in a warming world and we'd have more generalized thunderstorms but fewer supercells capable of producing tornadoes. That's not easily explained, but it's a somewhat more complex story than I think Americans may be getting, for better or worse. These are just some of the recent polling on the issue, and yes, people, the majority of Americans, do connect Hurricane Sandy to global warming, for better or worse. And as Gavin Schmidt said, you know, people are actively trying to interpret things. People are actively trying to seek out patterns that are shortcuts to explaining complex things. And just to whatever extent they're seeing weather that they perceive to be different than the weather they grew up with or the weather that their grandparents talked to them about, they are more likely to believe scientists when they talk about climate change. They're more likely to support certain policies, whether or not their beliefs match to the actual science. So with that, if we have time for any questions, we'd be happy to take them.
We do have time for questions.
Just for a lesser term, usually. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that that's the best analogy now in light of recent events, but I think that that's sort of how you, scientifically, how you need to view it and from a reporting perspective, because otherwise you end up saying, you know, global warming brought Hurricane Sandy up the East Coast and things like that, rather than, you know, the interaction between natural variability and global warming. Is a better story. It's a more interesting story. We'll see. I mean, I think I've only used that in a couple of stories and gotten pretty similar comments to what you just gave. So, yeah. Yes. You know, and I think there you're referring to some degree to Jennifer Francis's work out of Rutgers. We've been reporting on that. We were among the first to report on that at Climate Central, and we've been among the first to question it. I think that meteorologists more and more are finding the evidence to be pretty mixed on that front. You know, at a basic level, you cannot warm the Arctic to the degree that we have, melt the ice to the degree that we have, and not change something pretty fundamental about the climate system. But it may be that the impacts of that are largely contained within the Arctic, and the jet stream influence is not as significant. It may not. I think her research and the research of her colleagues is very intriguing and very interesting, and folks at the Weather Channel, even, whenever they see a blocking pattern, like we saw in March of 2012, like we saw in a couple winters that resulted in Snowmageddon in D.C., I think that is suspicious, and that's in keeping with her research. But the blizzard we just had, there was no blocking, and it's unusual to get a blizzard without really good Greenland blocking. So I don't know, but we're looking at that just as they are. Do you have time for one more?
Sure, we have two more.
Okay, go ahead. So the more certain one is sea level rise. When Sandy arrived in New York, the seas were 1 foot higher on average in New York City than they were a century ago. So there's actually a chart that the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research put out that just shows the highest water events in New York and the sea level rise component to those water events. And you see the little sea level rise component just growing with each event. And the thing that I like to say to people is, you know, to people in New York, and if you are a manager of the MTA, of the subway, inches matter a great deal. Hurricane Irene did not flood the subway, but it missed by inches, not feet. Sandy was a slam dunk for that. But I think between the sea level rise component, between having more atmospheric water vapor, having warmer sea surface temperatures, there was unusually warm sea surface temperatures off the Atlantic coast at that time. Whether that really played a huge role, it's unclear, because the storm was such a weird storm in its extratropical transition at the time. And NOAA just put out a report on that that I was reading that was just fascinating. That the links between that and warming are a little unclear right now. And I guess one more question? Yeah, in the back. Yeah, I think, you know, the Weather Channel started doing it responding to two things. One, in social media, people were naming the storms themselves. So Snowmageddon actually came from a blog that I used to write for. It came from the Capital Weather Gang in D.C. from a reader who suggested it, and then people voted for it. And my suggestion of, like, Kaiser Snoze from The Usual Suspects came in second, though. Yeah. But, you know, the Weather Channel is responding to this in the sense that it's a marketing gimmick on their part. They want to own the social media space about the storm and harness that. The Weather Service is not following it. I don't know how upset they are with it. They view it as a marketing gimmick. I think people in New England simultaneously looked at it as a, you know, naming a blizzard Nemo as a total joke. So maybe they need to improve their list. Because, like, they actually, lesser known blizzards this year have included, like, Gandalf. Whoever decided on these names, I think, it wasn't. Yeah, so if they're going to continue with this system, which I think they are, I'd like to see some different names.
All right, well, with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, you've heard from Don and Andrew some statements about extreme weather in general, and I wanted to talk about the tech and public perception of that. I want to talk about one specific example that I'm familiar with, being the Texas State climatologist, and that's we call it the Texas drought because we're Texas, but in 2011 it also affected Oklahoma and New Mexico, Louisiana, and so forth, but it was, and northern Mexico as well, but it was focused on us. And it was a drought that came upon us rather suddenly. This is a drought index product that we produce based upon the Weather Service's precipitation analysis, which gives us a very detailed representation of drought, or in this case, the lack thereof. By the end of September 2010, we'd had several tropical storms come through. The coastal regions were unusually wet. I won't go into the details of what these colors mean, except they're based upon percentiles. So exceptional wetness would be the second percentile historically of wet conditions over that six-month interval. Exceptional drought would be the second percentile of dryness. That was the start of the drought, really. The last storm went through Texas on September 27th, and then it turned dry. 3 months later, we had drought emerging, especially in East Texas. 3 months after that, it was widespread across the state. We started having major wildfires taking place at this time because of the combination of wet weather followed by extreme dry weather. That produces a lot of dry fuel. On top of that, spring 2011 was the windiest spring on record for the state of Texas. And then by June, we had run out of colors, much like Australia this year. Most of the state was in the exceptional drought category. It stayed that way through the rest of the summer. The precipitation totals through September were actually, for the year, about 11.5 inches, whereas the previous driest 12 consecutive months was 14-plus inches. So it broke that record by a large margin. The weather that got most of the national attention was during the summertime, where we had a combination of lack of rainfall and fairly high temperatures. This is a plot that shows historical values of rainfall and temperature during the summertime, and each dot represents a different year, going back to 1895 when the statewide records begin. And you can see there's a definite relationship between temperature and rainfall. The higher temperatures, which are on the y-axis, occur when rainfall is lower, and that's basic physics, really. You've got sunlight heating the ground. If there's less water to evaporate, then more of the energy goes into producing heat. There's also fewer clouds to block sun in the first place. So this was the historical expectation of the range of possible conditions. And this was 2011. Down in Texas, we call this an outlier. Other people call it a new normal, new trend, and really I like the term new abnormal because really this is not the sort of thing we expect to see being normal for many decades, even with the least optimistic projections. But it's the sort of thing that can occur potentially more and more frequently. Now, you've seen already a plot of a number of days over 100 degrees. The red in this is the number of days over 100 degrees Fahrenheit being greater than or equal to 100. So in analogy to the basketball triple-double, this is a double-triple. People actually don't have a good sense of what the normal weather is in Texas from other parts of the country. They think it all is like the barren West Texas of the movie Giant and that sort of thing. But the climate of Texas actually ranges from semi-arid in El Paso to the piney woods in East Texas, with rainfall varying from 10 inches to 60 inches. And as you saw, these temperatures are quite a bit unlike what is normal. And in fact, if you the previous record warmest summer was about 3 degrees Fahrenheit above normal on average, and this was 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. So it almost doubled the previous record. Gives you a sense of how exceptional it was. And then I mentioned the wildfires. Give you a sense of how large an area was affected. Of course, it included the size of Rhode Island. Every event includes the size of Rhode Island. But in this case, also all of Connecticut. And to actually get the numbers to match, we had to throw in New York City as well. Although that doesn't burn, that just gets attacked in all sorts of other ways by Hollywood. So the losses, just some of them, over $7.6 billion. This is just for the state of Texas alone for major agricultural losses. Timber losses, another nearly $1 billion. Insured property, mainly through fires, $500 million. And one of the fires that occurred, the Bastrop fire, I rated as the sixth most devastating fire to ever take place in the United States. And to bring home to people in Texas how unusual the weather was, I looked around the globe as to where it was the combination of the yearly rainfall and summertime temperatures would be considered normal. And that brings us to Asia, particularly central Pakistan, a city called Kushab, which indeed doesn't support forests. It has a quite different but well-adapted clothing style. And it also has a different mode of power generation, which is kind of secret. We can't really talk about it. Okay. Now, attribution study. We actually tried to do attribution not from necessarily the climate perspective, but actually from the traditional meteorological perspective, is to try to understand why, what sequence of predecessor events laid the groundwork for the drought and heat. Saying that the drought was due to natural variability is analogous to saying that the airplane crash was due to gravity. It's true, but it doesn't really tell you anything about the circumstances. And in this case, we have this outlier event. And, of course, we can't do experiments with the climate, but so attribution is largely an exercise of climate modeling. And one thing that proved to be important, that we suspected was important, was the distribution of ocean temperatures, because southern United States is known to be sensitive to El Nino, La Nina cycles in the Pacific Ocean. Particularly La Nina produces less rainfall across the southern U.S. in general. But the summertime, it doesn't generally have the same impact. But indeed, we found that based on model simulations, there was an impact. So here we're looking at simulations of the atmosphere based upon the observed ocean temperature patterns that took place during the summer of 2011 with the land surface initial conditions that were in place at the time. And each one of these dots is a different simulation. Each time you run the model, you get a different sequence of weather events because the weather is chaotic, but there's still this underlying deterministic component associated with the climate and how the ocean temperature patterns influence the weather. And what we see here is that basically the ocean temperatures made it almost impossible for us to have a cool summer, relatively speaking, and also almost impossible to have a wetter than normal summer. So it was going to be dry and warm based upon what actually happened with the ocean. If you're going to use this as a forecast, which is a little bit cheating because it uses knowledge of after the fact of the ocean temperatures, you would predict something somewhere in the middle of that cluster as being the most likely thing to have happened, and that would be about 30% below normal rainfall and about a degree to a degree and a half Celsius warmer. And the actual event, which is the blue piece of pasta up on top, is now, rather than being a extreme outlier, it's almost within the envelope of what the model simulated. So certainly the odds of this event on this particular year were increased greatly because of the particular sea surface temperature patterns. Now, global warming presumably may have had some influence in the particular pattern, but more certainly it had a general effect on temperatures overall. And if you just take a climate projection simulation, which doesn't know anything about the specific sea surface temperature patterns, you just get a slight amount of warming everywhere. Well, that's sort of like essentially the rising tide raising all boats. Each event, you could imagine in a hypothetical world with a non-global warming temperature background, would be slightly cooler than the same event with the global warming background. And that warming since 1995 is about half a degree Celsius. And if you raise all those events by that amount, you'd get our event actually being within the envelope. So a contribution to the extreme temperatures, but the global warming simulations don't indicate any significant change in precipitation up to this point. And so talking about it in terms of the impact on drought is a little bit more complicated. This is where we are beginning of the year, now 2 years into the drought. Much of the rest of the country has been experiencing what we started 2 years ago, but it hasn't gone away in Texas. Rainfall was below normal last year also, and reservoir levels right now across the state are capacity is the amount of water compared to capacity is lower for this time of year than it has been since the current reservoir system was in place. So we're looking at very potential major problems of water supplies going into the summertime. Okay, so possible ways climate change can affect drought. In addition to the direct amplifying effect of temperature, which not only increases the fire danger, makes it more unpleasant, but also increases evaporation and therefore decreases water supply. But in terms of rainfall itself, has climate change been decreasing the rainfall? Well, actually, no, it hasn't. You've seen a similar slide to this already, the precipitation trends over the past century or so, and they are positive in most of Texas by about 10 to 15%. So until we actually start seeing a long-term decrease of rainfall in Texas, it would be difficult to say that climate change has caused a decrease in rainfall. Although that raises another issue, this attribution thing, people tend to think of it in terms of components of an event, like say maybe global warming caused this much of it, this factor caused this much, and so forth. But these are not positive, definite processes. Events, some factors make things less likely. At the same time, other factors make the same things more likely. And so it's quite possible, for example, that this precipitation trend, which was perhaps largely due to natural variability, may have been even stronger in the absence of global warming. Precipitation is one of those things that, the models are not as solid on as, for example, temperature, because precipitation particularly is affected by a large variety of things, including aerosol content in the atmosphere, as well as land use, water supplies, and so forth. As far as ocean temperature patterns, I mentioned how important El Niño and La Niña were, and of course that's gotten a lot of detailed interest among scientists looking at whether that's going to change in the future. And right now all scientists agree that we do not know. The problem is that a couple of problems. First off, it's difficult to simulate La Niña with the right frequency and amplitude of a model to get those things right. We know some of the factors in the climate of the Pacific that cause it, and some of those factors are trending in a way to change things in one direction. Other factors are trending in the opposite direction. And then on top of that, in the historical record, El Niño, La Niña is a very erratic thing. It's not a periodic oscillation. So it takes a long time to actually detect a signal of a trend, if there is one. So at this point, we can't say whether climate change is making La Niña more likely or less likely, or therefore making the circumstances for drought in Texas more likely or less likely. But the temperature add-on is there. This is a graph of historical temperatures in different regions of Texas in color. And then I've tacked onto that on the appropriate scale the climate projections from the A1B scenario in the CMIT-3 simulations. And basically, the decade-smooth temperatures have been rising in Texas since the 1970s. Although the 70s were actually the coldest decade, and so up until recently, the linear long-term trend has been zero or slightly negative as part of the warming hole of the southeast U.S. But we have a positive trend since the 70s, and that's proceeding at the same rate as it's been projected to proceed. So presumably, if attributing all of that to global warming basically requires you to say that the models are correct about the expectation of warming, and all the other factors that affect temperatures are canceling each other out. So that gives you a sense of why it's difficult to actually pin down the effect of a single cause, the influence of a single cause on a perceived effect, because it's not a simple addition problem, and it's a complicated attribution problem both historically and present day. Okay, Don mentioned the warming effect of drought on soil temperatures, on soil conditions, and on drought frequency. There's been some recent work that came out end of last year. This is one of those papers that argues that the Palmer Drought Index really isn't a good measure because it essentially overestimates the effect of temperature on drought. And if you use a full soil model, to actually directly simulate evaporation processes, you do get increased drying due to the warming temperatures, but not nearly as catastrophic as that particular drought index would lead one to believe. So indeed, we do expect drought to become more severe in the future in Texas, although that has not happened yet. This event is still not quite as severe as the event of 1917-1918, but it's a climate change is a contribution. Okay, so what's this doing in the policy sphere? Because Texas is a red state, not because of drought, but because of political orientation. And because of the fact that temperatures have not really exceeded the previous historical bounds until just recently, we don't have the ability to observe climate change making obvious changes in the environment in Texas. Texas is lagging behind the rest of the globe in terms of the impact of climate change. So it's essentially one or two steps behind other places that have had more immediate consequences of climate change. There's an increased awareness of the importance of climate variability and how important water supply is to the economy, so that people are now aware of sensitivity to climate, not just because of personal comfort, but because of serious economic consequences also. And so we've got this need for legislative action to actually put money behind the plans for ensuring sufficient water supplies over the next 50 years, and also sort out the issue of who owns the water beneath the surface. For example, there was a court case in Texas in the spring that came out from the Supreme Court that basically said that the ownership of water, groundwater, is similar to the ownership of oil. If it's beneath your ground, you own it, you can pump it out, even though pumping it draws water from beneath other people's ground as well. And so management constraints on groundwater pumping, if they're not equitable, you need to actually compensate the owners who are losing the right to pump water. And so that tremendously complicates management issues, and so that's one of those things that the legislature is going to need to look at. In the Texas system, legislature meets every 2 years, and it's just beginning this year's session, which will last through the spring, and water is very near the top of their list. Of course, when you start running out of water, you start looking in other directions. And in fact, we've got ongoing lawsuits with Oklahoma, with Mexico, trying to, navigate the supply versus demand issue and find solutions there. You also find that there are stakeholders for water supplies that you didn't realize existed. For example, lakes built in central Texas for the purposes of supplying steady water to rice farmers no longer do that, because those are now urban water supplies, and even the real estate value of land along the lakeshore matters. So we've got all sorts of issues that are going to be sorted out over the next few months, I think, within the state. So to summarize, we've had a big impact so far on agriculture. It's made people aware of vulnerability to climate and potential sensitivity to climate change, even though climate change itself has had a relatively small apparent contribution to this current drought. Bigger impact on water supply has been the increasing population in Texas, and now we're having to deal with the long-term planning in the face of a short-term crisis, which makes it politically possible to do long-term planning, but it's too late for this particular drought. And that reminds us that the planning is great, but until you actually implement it, it's not especially useful. Thank you.
Time for a couple questions.
The seasonal forecasts from the Climate Prediction Center went with the standard impact of La Nina on the weather, and so therefore they were correct in the sense of enhanced odds of dry conditions. Certainly nobody expected it was going to be an outlier even within that envelope. Then making the forecast is one thing. The extent at which it gets to the farmers and ranchers is another. And I do not know how well that information was conveyed throughout the state. But then another issue arises is what you do with that information. A rancher can get through a mild drought just fine. It's the severe ones that require reduction of stock. And you don't really know whether you're going to need to do that until it gets close to happening, so it's difficult to take action in that regard. For farmers, you have this perverse system associated with crop insurance whereby if you do what seems to be the intelligent thing and not invest in seed, you don't actually get any benefit at all from your crop insurance. You have to actually plant something and watch it die before you get able to collect on the insurance. So we don't really have the ability to respond as effectively to climate forecasts as would be ideal. And at the same time, given the range of possibilities, even if you know the sea surface temperatures, climate forecasts are never going to be precise enough to take specific action. You'll only be able to plan for contingencies. Yes, the radars are too distant there, and because of mountains, there's not a lot of radar coverage, and because it's semi-arid, there's not a lot of ground-based gauges also, so that's the part of the analysis we least trust, and so we block it out for public consumption. The urban areas feel the impacts when water restrictions go into place. There were restrictions during 2011 across most of the state, but there were some potential uh-oh moments. For example, San Angelo, which is a population of over 100,000 in west central Texas, relies upon a reservoir which was down to less than 1 year's worth of water supply, and so the nearest groundwater resource was about 70 miles away. So there, it was a race between whether the year would end before they built the connection to the pipeline. Then rain came in September and gave them an extra year's worth of water. So now they not only do they have time to build the pipeline, they have time to build the water treatment plant to remove the radiative contamination from the water, which is beneficial. But other places, such as medium-sized cities, are having trouble, and Austin is in the middle of the debate because they're tied to the same reservoirs that supply rice farmers that have other uses as well. But it is a potential problem for policy, because we went through quite a while in 2012 when the main places where it rained were on the cities, and most people in Texas actually forgot that there was a drought. But we went through a dry fall, which reminded everybody again. Yeah, you're right in what you saw. In Texas, it's not entirely certain the droughts will become worse and climate change. In the southwest U.S., it's more likely. And in Mexico, it seems like it's written in stone. Every model agrees that it gets drier there. Complication in Texas is the models actually do very poorly and similarly in the current climate along in South Texas and northeastern Mexico, so there's a lot of question there. And so at least in the Texas part of the border, the border is formed by a river, which in parts of the border is now a river in name only. It's now two rivers. Rio Grande, that starts in Colorado, gets used by New Mexico and western Texas. And then the rest of the Rio Grande forms from water coming from Mexico and from the Pecos River. And reservoir systems then supply water for use downstream in both Mexico and the United States. At present, those reservoirs are at 40% of capacity and declining. And Mexico, according to the international agreement, owes water to those reservoirs, which obviously they can't deliver in a time of drought. So that has been something that has been a point of controversy for several years. There was an issue about how much water Mexico owed, and that's sort of settled down recently, but we may see that issue arise again. And in terms of what's going to happen in the future in Mexico and what that means for the southwest United States, that's probably a good question for Kathy Jacobs at the end of this, because she's been sort of focused on some of those issues being in Arizona, where you have, we're actually about 500 miles from Mexico, so it's a whole other country.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to do a quick swap with the computers here. Speaker is Camille Parmesan from the University of Texas, and her talk is on observed impacts of extreme climate events on wild species.
I'm not quite as tall as our other speakers, so I'm going to stand to the side. So if you look at the temperature trends over the last 50 years, you can see that there's a lot more warming in the boreal regions, and so it's no big surprise that and the boreal regions contain some of our most cold-adapted species. So it's no big surprise, then, that those species are showing the first declines that we're seeing in terms of negative impacts of climate change. And you've got massive loss of sea ice, as people have talked about. And I know everyone has heard about the polar bear, but what I want to remind people is that every species for which sea ice is habitat, including a lot of seals and sea lions, are also declining. And if you go down to the Antarctic, where you're also getting large losses of sea ice, particularly around the Palmer Peninsula, you're also getting very large declines, again, in species for which sea ice is their habitat. The two penguin species that we know a lot about are the emperor penguin and the adelie, where we're seeing 70 to 95% declines in the Palmer Peninsula. It was down to two breeding pairs of emperor penguins in that area. And I did hear a few weeks ago that those have gone extinct. Haven't had that verified. And in areas that are closer to the pole, the South Pole, where you've got slightly smaller declines of sea ice, you again have slightly smaller declines in terms of the sea ice-dependent species. Now, the other type of cold-adapted species we have on Earth are mountaintop species. And again, this is where we're seeing the first negative impacts of climate change. So declines in the lower elevation, extinctions actually, of the lower elevation populations of mountaintop species like the Apollo butterfly, the American pika, and the pika in Nepal. So these are species that already go to the top of the mountaintops. They're still up at that top, but the lower elevation populations are going extinct, so they're gradually becoming more and more confined to a smaller and smaller area of the mountaintop. So this is, in terms of extreme events, it's not so much that these are extreme events, but these are the extreme climates that we have on Earth, the extreme cold-adapted climates. We're seeing large negative effects on the species adapted to those climates. Now, when I was showing you the map of absolute temperature, the change, you can very clearly see that there's been strongest warming, especially in the northern hemisphere, in the Arctic regions, and in the montane regions, which didn't show up too well on that because you just don't have the resolution. But and that might make you think that, well, the rest of the world is okay. But if you look at this map, it's actually showing, rather than absolute change, the rate of temperature change in terms of shift in the isotherms, the temperature isotherms. And what you can see in areas that seem to have very little absolute change, those species that are adapted to a particular temperature are actually having to move a very long distance in order to maintain that same temperature profile. So the velocity of climate change has as big an impact, especially on the distribution of species, as the absolute temperature change. And so it's no big, and you can also think of timing of temperature in the same way. The timing of spring in the northern hemisphere, the timing of fall in the southern hemisphere, the advancement of those dates in terms of when it gets warm, when it gets cool in the fall, when it gets warm in the spring, it's not just, you're not getting the most rapid advancement necessarily in those boreal regions where you're getting the strongest absolute change. You're also getting very rapid advancement, for one thing, in the tropics, those strong green and pink colors in the tropics, and you're getting strong advancements in the open ocean regions, which aren't necessarily in an absolute sense having that dramatic a temperature change. So one reason I show this data to you is that an extreme, humans may not be able to perceive what an extreme is to a wild species, because these are extreme changes, even though in an absolute sense they don't seem that strong to us. And so it's no big surprise then we actually are seeing impacts throughout the world. These are five recent global meta-analyses, so each of these is taking species from around the world. They are not all the same data set. These are independent data sets. The first four are largely terrestrial. The last one is entirely marine. So we're now up to something like data on about 4,000 different species from around the world. And you can see the numbers changing are anywhere from 40% of species changing up to 76%. And to make this simple, I simply lumped together changes in distribution, changes in where things live, with changes in when things are living. So changes in timing and changes in distribution. And if you look at species that are changing, you can see that those changes are very, very highly consistent with what you'd expect from local or regional climate changes. So anywhere from 82% of the changes are consistent up to 92%. And the chance of those that being a random pattern is less than 1 in a billion in each of those cases. So to summarize very quickly, we're seeing about half of species have shifted where they live. About two-thirds of species have shifted the timing of major events, blooming, flowering, breeding, etc. We don't have data for everything, but everything for which we have appropriate data shows that every major group has been affected. So there's no single kind of taxonomic group that's not showing effects or that is immune. And impacts now we are seeing on every major continent and in every major ocean. So it's not just where you're seeing in an absolute sense the strongest changes, because species are responding to many, many variables of climate other than just change in global mean temperature, which is what I'm going to talk about now. So what's affecting most of those species where we have good biological information? It is extreme events driving those changes. It's not the change in average yearly mean. It's the short-term heat stress, short-term droughts, or even long-term droughts, short-term freezes. It's the extreme events throughout the year acting at key points in the life stages of these different species that is driving these changes in distribution and changes in timing. So I want to go through what's happening with one particular species that's my study organism, or one of them, Edith's checker spot butterfly. This is an old study. I just want to show it to you for context. These are all different populations that have been historically present populations that I recensused in the 1990s. Purple are populations that had gone extinct during that time period since they had been recorded. Green are populations that were still present. And you can see there's a very strong pattern in extinctions, very high extinctions down in Mexico and Southern California. These are not related to habitat loss, I should say. These are in areas where the habitat was still good. Moderate extinctions throughout the middle part of the range. Then you get up to Canada, very low extinctions. Similar thing with latitude, about 40 to 45% of the population's extinct at lower latitudes, elevations. And you get up to the highest elevations, above 8,000 feet, and less than 15% had gone extinct. And this shift in patterns of extinctions, this systematic trend, has shifted the average population northward by about 100 miles and upward by about 300 feet, which is exactly what you'd expect by the amount of warming, annual warming, that you've seen in these areas. But the drivers are not the mean annual temperature. So what's been happening? Throughout this range, first thing I want to say is even though it's one species, it uses many, many different types of host plant, lives in many, many different habitats from sea level up to 12,500 feet. It doesn't move a lot, so you get very, very strong local adaptation. This is what it looks like in all these different ecotypes. It's all one species. You can breed them in the lab, but they're very, very different not only in how they look, but in the suite of adaptations that they have to these different host plants and these different habitats. Now, the reason I'm saying all this is as soon as you realize that each population in each ecotype is actually using different plants, it's living in different habitats, it's no surprise that climate variability and climate trends is affecting them in different ways. So you can't say drought does this or freezes do that for the entire species, because they're all responding very differently to the climate in their regions. So to give you an example of I'm going to give you a series of examples of climate extremes that have caused populations to go extinct. And this has been observed in real time. So if we go to one set of populations in the San Francisco Bay Area, this is the subspecies, the Bay Checker Spot. This is what the Bay Area looked like in the 1960s when my husband took this picture. Very hard to find this nowadays. But there are these beautiful serpentine outcrops just covered in wildflowers. That was the habitat of the butterfly. This is its host plant, Plantago erecta. And as you can see, this is the adult butterfly, the mature host plant. She's going to lay about 150 eggs. So she needs a lot of really good, healthy host plants, very dense, in order to for that population to persist. Now, if you look at the life history of those low elevation populations that use these annual hosts, these small annual hosts, what you see is they do something very strange. So this is when the adults are flying, sort of around March or so, March and early April. All the plants, that's the host plants, they look like grass, it's not grass. Beautiful sea of dense host plants, nice and green. But as soon as she dies and her eggs are, all you have left are eggs, you're going to see that those plants are already starting to senesce. And by the time those eggs hatch and you've got her caterpillars out feeding, almost all the plants have already dried up. They're an annual in California. They're drying up in late April. And most of her offspring will starve. That's what happens in a normal year. That is what this species has adapted towards, what we call the ecological limits of their ability to live in this habitat. And evolutionarily, it's a trade-off between adult fecundity and offspring survival. So we do understand why this happens. But what I'm trying to say is in a normal climate year, the butterflies really are already out of sync with their host plants. So it's very easy to see that if you warm temperatures up a little bit, and people have done this experimentally and in the field, in greenhouses and in the lab, you warm things up by as little as 2 degrees centigrade, the host plants dry up just a few days earlier. That's enough. They already have a very short window anyway. You make that window even shorter. And normal starvation, where 90 to 95% of the caterpillars starve, which is in a normal year, goes to 100% and the population goes extinct. So we know, we understand this mechanism in these sort of coastal, low elevation populations using annual host plants. Populations go extinct all the time, naturally. Climate change appears to be increasing the rate of extinction in these populations through this mechanism. And when I was doing fieldwork down in Mexico, where we have that 75% of historic populations have gone extinct, you actually saw this mechanism in action. So this is the plantago down there. It's the same species, but it's just very dry habitat. It doesn't get very big. This is a mature plant. That is an egg mass. And what I saw were egg masses on plants that were already starting to senesce, caterpillars on plants that had about 20% green material left or even all dry. So it was very easy to see that even the populations I still saw were getting so horribly out of sync with their host plant that the likelihood of them surviving was very low. And indeed, we have a very high rate of population extinctions down there. So that's one mechanism. You warm it up a little bit, you've got an organism that already has a very difficult adaptation to its habitat. It's not optimum as humans might see it. And so a little bit of climate change makes a huge effect, even though it doesn't seem like it's that much in an absolute sense to us. So in the drought can also cause this increase of asynchrony. The California drought of 76-77 was associated with a lot of population extinctions. And again, at these lower elevations, coastal populations feeding on this annual plantago, they had declines by more than 5 times in that year, that single year, 1 year. They dropped down by in numbers by more than 5 times. And that was, the host plants were still there, but they were drying up too soon. But what's interesting are these yellow dots, and most of these were in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. The drought had a different impact, an even more extreme impact, in which, again, it was little annual host plants, now this thing called a calendula, and the host plants simply did not germinate. They're an annual. They can choose to remain a seed if they feel the year is not good enough for them to be able to become adults and reproduce. And whole populations had zero germination of the host plants. Now, unfortunately, the caterpillars don't have that option. They've got to come out of their winter resting phase, which we call diapause. They have to eat something. They can go back into diapause if they realize it's a bad year, but they've got to eat for 2 or 3 days, and go through one instar, have a molt, get a little bit bigger, get some more reserve so that they can survive the next 11 months and try it again the next year. This year, they had absolutely zero host plant, and this was Mike Singer went around and actually physically surveyed these populations when they should have had host plants and caterpillars, found none, went back a little later, found no adults, and the next year, these populations were extinct, and they remained extinct for about the next 25 years. And finally, a lot of them have been recolonized, but it took 20 or 25 years for that to happen. So again, very different mechanism, a more extreme mechanism, caused extinction of those populations. Now, when you get to higher elevation, the driving mechanism is really snowpack. So the plants tend to germinate just as the snow is about to melt. They actually start germinating when you still have an inch or so of snow, you know, just so that the light is able to filter down. The caterpillars come out right at snow melt. And so what's been happening with snowpack in the Sierra Nevada is below 8,000 feet, 2,400 meters, you've had, and most of these are pink. And pink to red colors mean lighter snowpack. I've really got to do something about this. So below 8,000 feet, you've had lighter snowpack, and snow melt is about 2 weeks earlier than it was 50 years ago. It switches around. That trend very suddenly switches around at 8,000 feet. Above 8,000 feet, as Don was saying, warmer air temperatures hold more precipitation. You've got heavier snowfall, and snowmelt has changed by about a week, but it's not significant. So what's the impact of that on the butterflies? Well, above 8,000 feet, they're doing great. Remember, that's the same cutoff, the same elevational cutoff that we got with extinction rates. Above 8,000 feet, less than 15% have gone extinct. They're doing beautifully. They like heavy snowpack. It forces them to stay in until July and August when the weather is absolutely gorgeous. They have good hot daytime temperatures. They can get through their cycle and go back in diapause by late September. But below 8,000 feet, what we were seeing is they were emerging way too early. You were getting what we call false spring events. So you would get this snowpack melting very early. You'd get butterflies flying in April when they should have been flying in June. And what that's showing you here is this was flight season, and you got what was a perfectly normal snow or freeze for April at 7,500 feet. But the adult butterflies are not adapted to this. If it happens when the caterpillars are in diapause, no problem. They can handle anything. You can take them down to -5, they're fine. But the adults are not prepared for snow and freezing. So a series of these false spring events, after three of them happened during the 1990s, every time one happened, you had massive declines. By the third one, a whole series of populations in this area went extinct. They have not been recolonized. They went extinct in 1992, and they have not yet been recolonized. So that's three very different mechanisms that we've seen by biologists being out in the field at the time these events have happened. We've seen that these were the drivers of population extinctions. And as we're getting more into the details of the system, we're finding other factors that we didn't even know about. This is brand new research. What we're finding is that we knew that eggs were laid at very different heights, different host plants, different adaptations. This is a bog in Oregon. They're laid right at the top of this castilleja, Indian paintbrush as the common name. And when they're laid at the top of this plant over a bog, those eggs are actually at cooler than ambient temperature. But on the other hand, you go up to, I think this is about 10,000 feet, very, very intense sun. They're laying at the bottom of, again, it's a castilleja, but they're laying right at the bottom. That's actually a web right there. And the soil heats up astonishingly. The actual soil temperature can be 52 to 53 centigrade. And at where the egg mass is laid is about 19 degrees hotter than ambient. So if you put all that together, you've got this huge array of microclimatic temperatures, even when the ambient temperature is not very different amongst these different populations. What the eggs are experiencing is wildly different, with the coolest temperatures being at the hot, where they're laid at the tops of the plants or higher above the ground, going to hotter and hotter temperatures as you lay them closer to the ground. And this variation is much greater than the actual variation in mean temperature for the season, for the flight seasons. And what's interesting is when you get up to these very hottest temperatures, you're actually getting near the lethal temperature. So the hottest observed was 47 degrees centigrade. That's an actual measured temperature in the field. And we know from taking them into the lab that if you keep them at 48 for more than a half an hour to an hour, the eggs die. They don't survive. So you have populations already laying their eggs because of other selection pressures. They're not necessarily laying them to get the heat. In this case, it's to avoid predation. We know that by laying them right at the ground, the deer don't come by and graze the tops and eat the eggs inadvertently. So the selection pressure of grazing has moved them to lay them lower and lower towards the ground, and yet that's now getting towards lethal temperature. So again, just a little bit of increase in maximum daytime temperature, or even one or two days that are a little bit hotter, could drive those populations extinct. So what I've shown you is here's one species with three very, very different types of extreme climate events driving population extinctions, heat waves increasing asynchrony, causing starvation, drought years not only increasing asynchrony, but can actually totally disrupt the interaction between the plant and the caterpillar, low snowpack causing false springs, and I told you about the adults getting killed by normal freezes. I didn't mention that one year, actually, we found the adults flying when the plants had not yet bloomed. There was absolutely no nectar, and the adults starved. We had a hillside full of bright orange wings where the wings were still soft, showing that they were actually dying within less than a day. And then some populations we're now seeing as we get more into the system, they're already laying eggs in very hot microclimates near lethal temperatures. We don't yet know, since we only just discovered this, we don't really have an idea of what climate change means for those populations. So what does this have to do with kind of the big picture? Well, a lot of people are advocating that we come up with these process-based ecological models of how climate drives particular populations or species, so that we can couple these ecological models with the climate models and come up with very quantitative estimates, not only of how much the observed changes we're seeing have been driven by anthropogenic climate change, so the attribution question that John was talking about, but also to come up with more specific predictions about what's going to happen over the next 50 to 100 years. As a field biologist, the take-home message I want to give you is even with one species that we've studied since Ehrlich started studying it in the early 1950s, we know it really well. Dozens of researchers have studied this one species. We are starting to understand how climate variability affects it, but we still have things that we're discovering. Even for that species, we cannot come up with this sort of nice, neat process-based ecological model. So I hate to be a negative, but I really think it's very, very obvious that anthropogenic climate change is affecting wild species. Those global meta-analyses I showed are a very strong indication of that. We can look at single systems and find multiple lines of evidence that anthropogenic climate change is driving changes in distribution, declines, changes in timing. But to try to make specific predictions about what's going to happen over the next 50 to 100 years is quite frankly beyond our abilities, given the level of detail that you need to come up with those types of process-based models. But that doesn't mean that we can't come up with conservation solutions, and that's a different talk, but I'm happy to talk with you about that if you're interested. Thank you.
Questions for Camille just until the end here. We'll need to move on to the next speaker. All right, our next speaker is David Staley from the University of Arkansas, and his talk is on the treeing record of drought over North America.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be in this session and speak in behalf of my friend and colleague Ed Cook at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and speak about the ancient history and prehistory of climate as told by trees, including Sierra juniper in the granite uplands above Yosemite Valley in California, which are centuries old and contain a record in their tree rings of Sierra snowpack in Central California, and swamp bald cypress trees at Black River, North Carolina. Some of these trees are over 1,500 years old and also contain a long record in their tree rings of growing season precipitation variability in spite of their wetland habitat. And we see down below a core sample from a cypress tree in southeastern Virginia, you know, and the annual rings, which are, of course, a couplet of the early wood and the late wood. Together, they constitute the annual ring. And they can be exactly dated to the calendar year of formation with the dating method dendrochronology, the most accurate and precise dating method in geochronology. And then we can use the interesting variability in the width of the rings to infer variability in climate. And so we've got tens of thousands of core samples from tens of thousands of trees at thousands of sites across North America that are being used for this purpose. And so this is the network of tree ring chronologies now available in North America. By last count, there's over 2,000 tree ring chronologies. All of them include rings that date before 1800. Most are at least 300 years long. Many are over 1,000 years long. The typical chronology includes cores, maybe 40 cores from 20 trees. And the area in red is where we have developed tree ring chronologies, and my colleague Jose Villanueva in Mexico. So there are many species involved in this network, and we list them for the eastern United States and western United States by their rough rank order of importance. There's several white oak species, hemlock bald cypress in the east, ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, and so forth in the west. They all kind of encode climate variability or respond to climate variability a little bit differently. And so, but in tropical North America, subtropical and temperate North America, most of them record some kind of soil moisture signal. And so we like the Palmer Drought Severity Index. It's taken a little heat in this succession so far. But, you know, the Palmer Drought Severity Index is a measure based on precipitation and temperature data of the soil moisture balance. And it's well correlated with tree growth. And it has the additional virtue of actually being available on a gridded basis and has been available for many years as, since we started this research. And so Ed Cook developed this point-by-point principal component regression procedure for estimating the Palmer Index at this half a degree grid of data that have been made available from the, you know, spatially complex distribution of weather recording stations. The PDSI has been calculated and then interpolated to a half a degree grid across North America. I don't show the grid, but there's like 11,000 grid points. And at each grid location, we search in the vicinity for tree ring chronologies that are correlated significantly with PDSI at that grid point. And then for those selected chronologies, we perform principal components analysis and pass the amplitude time series on as predictors of PDSI at that grid point. And over the entire continent, we're explaining, on average, about 50% of the variance. We do much better than that in some areas, more indifferently in others. And when you compare it with statistically independent data in the early 20th century, we're verifying a little bit less, maybe 40, 45% of the variance. But still, the tree rings are tracking climate variability with great fidelity. And so we illustrate this for the most famous drought so far, I would say, in American history, the Dust Bowl drought. And so on the left, you see the instrumental Palmer drought indices based on thermometers and rain gauges averaged at each grid point. There's 11,000 some odd of them for the full 10-year period of the 1930s, and then isopleth. And so the hot colors are representing drought of increasing severity, and the cool colors, moisture. And on the right, we show the tree ring reconstructions of the Palmer Drought Index, averaged again at each grid point for the full 10 years, and then isopleth. And you can see the amazing fidelity with which the tree ring world represents the real world. You had coast-to-coast dryness in the 1930s that was most intense in the central and northern Great Plains, and northern Rockies. And, of course, the virtue of the tree rings is they're substantially longer than the available instrumental record and provide a deep time perspective. The tree rings tell us that the Dust Bowl drought was the worst decadal drought in the last 350 years. If you look deeper back in time, in medieval times, for example, we do see more persistent and profound and prolonged droughts in medieval times. The Dust Bowl drought's impact, of course, was famously impacted by poor land use practices and the plowing of the plains and so forth. There's been recent research by our next speaker, Richard Seeger and Benjamin Cook, that have shown that the anthropogenic alteration of the land surface has, in fact, maybe contributed to the climate dynamics that caused this Dust Bowl drought to be so severe, to be so prolonged, and to affect such a large area. And so really, I mean, this might be the first major decadal drought with evidence for an anthropogenic enhancement. We can look at more anecdotal historical evidence for validation of the tree ring estimates. And so the exploration of the West included Zebulon Pike's expedition in 1806. He crossed the Great Plains to Colorado and New Mexico, was detained by the Spanish, taken to Chihuahua, finally made it back to Texas, traversing an area of very intense drought in 1805 and 1806, and he described the regions like the sandy deserts of Africa. Later, Stephen Long's expedition in 1820 crossed the plains again through Nebraska to Colorado, describing the area as wholly unfit for cultivation. This famously led to the theory of the Great American Desert. Historians have argued that perhaps the perceptions of Pike and Long were both biased by their roots in the humid climate of the eastern United States, but the tree ring data affirm that there was intense drought during the period of their expeditions. So one of the major motivations for doing tree ring reconstructions of climate is to provide a paleoclimate perspective on modern climate variability and modern climate extremes. So we've heard now about these epic droughts last year and, well, 2 years ago, the 2011 drought in Texas, which is the worst drought in the meteorological record of the history of the state of Texas starting in 1895, shown here with an evaporative stress index at the height of the drought, perhaps in July of 2011. But the tree rings suggest it can get worse, if not more intense, at least more prolonged. So we reconstruct a three-year drought in the mid-19th century, 1855 to 1857, that afflicted pretty much the same area of Texas and the southern Great Plains as the 2011 drought. And it included the so-called sitting summer of 1855, when the ponies of the nomadic Kiowa were too weak to ride, and thus they record in their summer count calendar the sitting summer. They were reduced to sitting around because the drought-blighted prairies were too poor to provide pasturage for their ponies. The drought of 2012 was impacted the Corn Belt and the Ozarks, and was the warmest year in American history, in the thermometric history of the United States, and I think also the warmest summer. But it was duplicated really many times, at least in area, if not intensity, including this three-year drought at the turn of the century, this being the turn of the 19th century. Of course, we just lived through a turn of the 21st century drought that's still persisting in the West. And so what's worrisome, these patterns of drought over the Corn Belt and over the Southern Plains are recurrent patterns that we see in the modern instrumental record. I mean, they've happened before. They're recurrent in the tree ring record as well, where they may have persisted for multiple years. But what's worrisome is that the escalation in temperature may cause these kind of normal recurrent drought patterns to be more intense and prolonged. So a little ancient history now. The ancestral Pueblo culture extended across the southwestern United States from the Great Salt Lake of Utah into the Chihuahuan deserts of northern Mexico, included villages like the cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde National Park, and reached their zenith in the 12th and 13th centuries. And the entire northern Colorado Plateau, which had previously been occupied by the Anasazi, is abandoned at the end of the 13th century, and one of the great enigmas in the archaeology of the American West. And so it was A.E. Douglas that developed the dating technique known as dendrochronology, made the first millennium-long tree ring chronology in the world, the so-called Central Pueblo dating chronology. He used that chronology to date the construction of ruins like Square Tower House and others through sampling the vigas and other wood remains. He noted in the dating chronology, the Central Pueblo dating chronology, a long period of deficit growth and inferred drought, you know, contemporaneous in the late 13th century with the end of construction and with the abandonment of this region. And he developed the drought hypothesis for the Anasazi depopulation of the Southwest. So the new tree ring reconstructions that we now have, which are based on substantially more tree ring data than were available to Douglas at the time of his research, are shown in the map here for the full 22-year period, 1276 to 1297, indicate intense drought throughout the Anasazi cultural area in the late 13th century, so certainly affirming, you know, the presence of this drought. We've recently returned to Mesa Verde, resampled living trees and archaeological timbers, and built this long chronology shown down below. We've used this long chronology to estimate water year precipitation for the Mesa Verde region. Turns out that water year precipitation is fairly strongly and approximately linearly related to elevation in this portion of southwestern Colorado. So you can estimate the 30-centimeter precipitation isohyet, the elevation of that, you know, back through time for 1,500 years. That 30-centimeter precipitation, annual precipitation, is considered the absolute minimum necessary for the rain-fed cultivation of maize. And so we see really in the 12th and 13th century really three great Pueblo droughts, and two of them have already been associated with migrations among the ancient Anasazi, the mid-12th century, the depopulation of the Chaco Canyon region, and the late 13th century, you know, the abandonment of the northern Colorado Plateau. So we can map this spatially, this elevation zone, for what we refer to as the viable dryland farming zone. During the worst 5 years of the Great Pueblo Drought from 1276 to 1280. So we show that zone of viable farming in dark green. Above that zone, above about 2,400 meters or 7,800 feet, normally too cold, you know, to practice maize agriculture. And we estimate that during the drought, below, you know, it was too dry below about 2,040 feet, 6,600 feet for rain-fed maize agriculture. So this reconstruction suggests that the Great Drought, at least the initiation of the Great Drought, would have been felt first at lower elevations amongst the Anasazi agriculturalists. And in fact, this might be a testable hypothesis. There are over 20,000 Pueblo III sites distributed across the Four Corners region, including in the dark gray zone, which we estimate to have been too dry, you know, for normal agriculture among the Anasazi. And so a lot of these Pueblo III sites, that's the period of ancestral Pueblo history in the 12th and 13th century, have also been tree ring dated. So we would predict that abandonment proceeded up the elevational gradient of the Southwest. Of course, this reconstruction has negative implications for modern agriculture and ranching in the Southwest, where you are, in the event of a deepening drought, would be caught between perhaps a rock and a hard place, as it were, and also has negative implications for lower elevation forest dieback on this same elevation gradient in the event of deepening drought. Thank you.
Questions for Dave?
Not exactly, but Cortez, you see the town, modern town of Cortez. Hovenweep, I think, is just on the Utah border northwest of Cortez. And I don't know the elevation of Hovenweep, but there are some major sites that were abandoned at this time that are in the gray zone. You know, the typical agricultural zone is considered to be the Great Sage Plain between about 1,500 and 2,000 feet. So the dark green during the Great Drought, 5 years of it, is well above the zone that was normally farmed. Well, I wouldn't say well calibrated, but I mean it has been used. The tree ring record has been used to validate model projections based on sea surface temperature conditions in the 19th century, for example, and where we don't have such good spatially distributed estimates of moisture conditions. So, you know, there have been a number of studies of mid-19th century drought and other droughts in the 19th century that have utilized the tree ring record over North America. It's expanding, of course. I mean, we have a very mature network for North America, but there's an outstanding array of tree ring chronologies, very sensitive to climate. They're being developed in the Mediterranean basin, Western Europe, and Asia as well as portions of South America. Well, in medieval times, the so-called climatic optimum. I'm less familiar with the tree ring record for Western Europe. There's a project underway now to try to reconstruct drought over Europe. I'm not sure that it will reach back quite that far to medieval times. Especially in southern Europe, there's an outstanding array under development. A little, yeah. I mean, this is one of the worst droughts in the last 1,000 years over a good chunk of Western North America, the 16th century mega drought, as it's sometimes referred to. You know, that's the dawn of European colonization in the New World. And not so much, so this drought in the 16th century extended across Western North America down into Central Mexico, where we do have some records of environmental conditions, and it's been associated, this drought, with, this period of drought has been associated with epidemic disease that afflicted native Mexicans, you know, at the time of conquest. So, but in the interior of the United States, there's less information for this period, but it shows up again and again. It extended all the way across at times in the late 16th century to the tidewater region of the eastern United States, where during a portion of the 16th century mega drought, you had 1587. That's the so-called Lost Colony Drought. That's when Sir Walter Raleigh's colony on Roanoke Island disappears from history. And so there's this anecdotal evidence that the drought was real. And we have no reason to doubt it. It's seen in so many trees across such a large fraction of North America. So, I mean, droughts have happened, and we know that epic droughts of, you know, great proportions and lasting for decades at a time have happened for sure. But of course, what's worrying is that the escalation in temperature will augment this natural variability, as has been pointed out already.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'll wrap this up. And where are we right now in terms of drought in North America? So at the top right is the drought monitor map from that was issued yesterday, dated on Tuesday, and as we know, we're now well into the third year of what is turning out to be a pretty serious drought in much of Western North America and the plains. The whole middle of the country there is in severe to exceptional drought. The North American drought monitor is the one on the left, which is only updated once every month, and the last one I have is for December of last year. And you can see that this drought has extended down into northern Mexico. It was more severe in northern Mexico in the last year than it has been in this current year. And the picture on in the bottom right is the pool elevation of Lake Powell, which is one of the two big reservoirs on the Colorado River system, the two, Lake Mead and Lake Powell in combination, store about 5 years of Colorado River flow. Powell was built in the early 1960s and began filling up, and you can see that it went into a very serious drought around about 1998 and has had a partial recovery since then, but is still only about 50-60% full right now. As we move on to the end of my talk, we will conclude that that reservoir is unlikely to ever return to levels, ever to return to levels that it had in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s. Okay. This current drought that we are in now is almost certainly very linked to ongoing evolutions of sea surface temperature conditions within the tropical Pacific Ocean. We do have a pointer here. Yes, so the maps here go from fall of 2010 through to fall of 2011. So this drought began in fall of 2010, and as we saw in an earlier talk, it pretty much came out of nowhere at that time, but it went along with these cold sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean that persisted through 2010-2011, and they seemed to start going away, and then they started coming back. This is a La Nina state in the fall of 2011. The tropical Atlantic Ocean was warm as well, and that's kind of a perfect condition you need for drought in North America. Going on through 2011 into 2012, that La Nina redevelops in winter of 2011 and 2012. But then it did go away in 2012. By the time we got through to summer of 2012, we actually had weak warm SSTs, sea surface temperatures, in the tropical Pacific Ocean. But you can see that the drought intensified in spring and then through to the summer of 2012, especially in the northern plains and in the Midwest. So the intensification of that drought happened actually as the La Nina state was going away. So I think it's going to be very hard to say that the summer of this drought last year was related to the tropical sea surface temperature conditions, to the extent that the tropical oceans exert a control over North America in the summer. You would want a cold tropical Pacific to get a drought, but we did go over to a warm tropical Pacific. So within the previous 2 years, we were getting drought associated with the La Nina, so there was an oceanic control, but in this, by the time we came through to summer, I would imagine there was a high degree of just internal atmospheric variability that happened to add on to this and led to this intensification at that time. So this association of North American drought with a cold tropical Pacific, La Nina, sea surface temperature anomalies is very typical. We've seen this before. And in instrumental records, this has been going on for over a century. And we know this from climate modeling work that our group has done and other groups have done, where we use atmosphere models and we run underneath those atmosphere models essentially a tape recorder history of ship observed sea surface temperatures. Those go back into the mid-19th century, ship observed sea surface temperatures, and then you can see how well the atmosphere model is capable of reproducing observed variations in hydroclimate. And here we have a comparison actually of observations-based soil moisture anomalies. So these are actually simulations of soil moisture that were done where you take the observed air temperature, air humidity, winds, and so on over a land hydrology model and compute and observe precipitation and compute the amount of moisture in the soil. And then that's compared with what we get from a global atmosphere model that's only forced with the sea surface temperature histories. And this is for the Great Plains on the left, and this is for Southwest North America on the right. And one of these, which one is it? The black is the observed soil moisture in the Great Plains, and the blue is what the model did. And the top ones are for the case where the atmosphere model knows about global sea surface temperatures, and then the bottom case is for where the atmosphere model only knows about tropical Pacific sea surface temperatures. And you can see that in both cases there's a sizable amount of agreement between these. In the southwest, we've got these dry periods in the 1950s in the southwest, and in the plains as well, this very wet period in the 1980s and 1990s, and then a return back to this drought in after the turn of the century. And you can reproduce most of that with just tropical Pacific sea surface temperatures. So what we're seeing in these records is that the atmosphere model simulations are confirming that the time history of natural variations of sea surface temperatures, especially in the tropical Pacific Ocean, have it exerting a strong control over precipitation and hence soil moisture, drought characteristics throughout Western North America. Using the tree ring data that Dave Staley talked about before, and we make extensive use of this to look at times before the 20th century, you can regress the Palmer Drought Severity Index that comes out of the tree ring records against indices of tropical sea surface temperature. So this is the pattern you expect when the tropical Pacific sea surface temperature is warm, and you see that it gives you positive peak drought severity index. That's wet conditions all the way from northern Mexico across the southwest and up into the plains. So drought conditions would be when you have cold sea surface temperature. And then there's a weaker correlation to the tropical North Atlantic Ocean. So that has a similar kind of area, although it's a maximum in Texas, eastern part of Mexico. But in that case, it's when the tropical Atlantic is warm, you end up with drought conditions in this region here. That is an important relation, but it's definitely weaker than the relationship to the tropical Pacific. But if you really want the very perfect conditions, you would want a cold tropical Pacific Ocean and a warm tropical North Atlantic. And the way that that works is that in both cases, the atmosphere over those oceans responds, the circulation anomaly changes, and that has a knock-on effect and changes atmospheric circulation all over the world, including in ways that will cause drought over North America. So looking at ship-observed sea surface temperatures during major North American droughts, this is during the 1930s, so it's 32 to 39, the 1950s drought, and then the one from 1998 to 2003, all of these went along with these cold tropical Pacific sea surface temperatures. In the 30s and 50s, we also had that ideal condition in that the tropical Atlantic was warm. And then going back to three that we know occurred in the 19th century, one from 1856 to 65, and then the 1870s and the 1890s. Again, in all of these multi-year droughts, we had cold sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean. For the 19th century ones, there was nothing going on much in the Pacific, in the Atlantic Ocean. So these three mid to late 19th century droughts were almost entirely forced by the tropical Pacific Ocean. So they're fitting. There's a consistency of this, and this is just natural variability of the oceans going on every year. Every now and then, the tropical Pacific Ocean gets stuck in these multi-year La Nina states, and we get a drought in North America. So the 1950s drought, which set a lot of records for heat and dryness in the southwestern North America, is one of these, and this is one that climate models simulate very well. This is the observed precipitation anomaly from rain gauge data, and these are our model simulations of precipitation anomaly that we get in the case where the atmosphere model is forced with global sea surface temperature forcing. That does pretty well. The drought was centered over in the southwest and the southern plains, wet conditions around it. This is what you get, these two, where we only had tropical Pacific sea surface temperature forcing, and this is the case where we only force the atmosphere model with tropical Atlantic sea surface temperatures. And you can see that in order to get the thing with the total sea surface temperature forcing, we need both the Pacific SSTs and the Atlantic sea surface temperatures too. And when we have all of those, we can actually reproduce the precipitation reduction that went into the 1950 Southwest drought. The Dust Bowl drought of the 1930s, however, was a little bit different. This is the observed precipitation anomaly for that, and this one was not centered in the southwest, which is where the biggest oceanic control is exerted, but was more in the central plains and up to the northern plains. So when our atmosphere model is given the global SSTs, we, however, produce a drought that is, again, down in the southwestern part of the United States and in northern Mexico. It, again, depends on both the Pacific sea surface temperatures and, again, it depends on the Atlantic sea surface temperatures, but our drought is too far to the south of the observed one. Our drought in the model is where you typically expect a drought when you have a cold Pacific and a warm Atlantic. That's always sets up drought in Mexico and southwest and southern plains. However, the 1930s drought was unique in North American droughts, both before and after, in that it was the only one that went along with extensive soil erosion and dust storms, and that was due to farming practices at the time that led to non-drought-resistant wheat that had been planted there since the early 1920s, dying, exposing enormous amounts of bare soil to the atmosphere, and that being lifted up and creating these tremendous dust storms. The Soil Conservation Service at the time, it was formed in 1936, prepared a whole load of maps of where the erosion was occurring, and what we did was we took those maps from the 1930s, and in our atmosphere model at the surface, we converted what is normally the atmosphere model sees a crop there. We converted the correct proportion to bare earth, and then the atmosphere model was able to lift the dust up. The dust gets blown around in the model atmosphere, interacts with solar radiation and so on, and you can get a climate impact from that. So again, this is what the observed rain gauge data for the precipitation reduction during the 1930s. This is what the model gets when we only have the sea surface temperature forcing, and this is what we get when we then additionally turn on active dust storms. So the model creates the dust storms just from the fact that there's bare soil at the Earth. You know, it doesn't. We're not directly putting the dust into the atmosphere. It only lifts it up when it can, but it does. It created tremendous dust storms. And you can see that we now end up with a dust bowl drought that is correctly centered in the northern and central plains, and it's much more intense than what you've get from the sea surface temperature forcing alone. And if you go back through a lot of other comparisons of meteorological records at the time against what the model simulation does in the presence of the dust storms, we feel you can pretty much clearly say that the dust storms were important to generating the character and intensity of the Dust Bowl drought. In other words, this is a drought that was initiated by the oceans, but it then was amplified by human action at the time. Fortunately, a lot of lessons were learned about how to manage the land to prevent this from ever happening again, and we haven't seen anything like it again. Okay, now, going back to the tree ring data, as Dave said, we have this tremendous record of tree rings from all over the United States, and these are maps, these are time series of the Palmer Drought Severity Index for 1,000 years, going back to 1,000 up to 2,000 for the southwest United States. So Dave was talking about, I can't quite see the dates on here, but the 13th century and 12th century droughts in the southwest that appear here. And then for the Great Plains and the northwest, I'd like to draw your attention first to the Great Plains, because although these very long and severe droughts in the medieval period appeared in the southwest, they apparently were even more severe in the Great Plains, that the Great Plains seems to be the place where the longest and most severe droughts did develop. And they're not always at the same time as the ones in the southwest. So when we hear about medieval mega droughts, don't think that they were all the whole of North America or the whole west all at the same time. Sometimes that happened, but sometimes you could have multi-decadal droughts going on in the Great Plains that didn't influence the southwest, or vice versa. So these are relatively complex in their anatomy. The southeast is rather interesting in that before the 20th century, it seems to have been overwhelmingly a drier climate than it is now. It's a very different record there. Interestingly enough, this unusual drought pattern of the 1930s, in which we had a drought in the central northern plains and not centered in the southwest, if you look through the drought atlas, you can find there were a handful of other droughts that had a very similar pattern. For example, this one in the late 15th century or the mid-12th century, they were all in that medieval period. The only times we've had drought spatial patterns like the Dust Bowl were in this medieval period of these mega droughts, which is interesting because we know from records of now fossilized dune fields in the Great Plains that these were all times of active dune fields in the plains. And we have simulated those, which is a bit of a tricky exercise because we don't have ship observations of sea surface temperature during the medieval period, but what we do have are tropical corals whose geochemistry records the temperature of the water that they were growing in when they were alive. And there's a record from Palmyra Island in the tropical Pacific that indicated overwhelmingly cold sea surface temperatures in the period that coral was alive, which was 1320 to 1480. And on the basis of that record and knowing typical patterns of sea surface temperature anomalies, we can infer a tropical Pacific sea surface temperature pattern that, again, we then use underneath an atmosphere model to simulate the atmospheric response to that Pacific sea surface temperature anomaly. And then this is the Palmer Drought Severity Index from 1320 to 1480 that we get in the atmosphere model when all it knows about is that sea surface temperature anomaly. And because it was cold at La Nina conditions, we do get droughts during that period within the plains. But then at the bottom here, we've done the same thing as we did for the Dust Bowl, in that we've allowed where the geomorphology tells us that the dune fields were active, like the Nebraska Sandhills is one case, we removed the vegetation cover in the model and we put active dunes there. And again, the atmosphere model can lift the dust up, the dust interacts with the radiation and you can get a climate response. And then we find that what was initially a sea surface temperature force drought, the interactive dust converts that into a multi-decadal drought, which now is beginning to match in length and severity the kind of droughts that we know existed at that time from the tree ring records. The way that this dust feedback works is that the dust reflects solar radiation to space, creates an energy sink within the region of the dust in the atmosphere, and the only way the atmosphere can deal with that energy sink is by importing energy to that area, which requires air coming in at the top, subsiding and going out at the bottom, and the subsidence within the dust cloud suppresses precipitation. Okay, so historical droughts we know were caused by patterns of tropical sea surface temperature anomalies. These medieval mega droughts, we have linked them to tropical sea surface temperatures, but we have poor records of that. So there's still an unknown origin of what was going on in general in the medieval period to create such intense droughts. But now we're dealing with something rather different in that we're moving into a greenhouse world. Climate is changing due to rising greenhouse gases, and that's going to be introducing a new type of North American drought driven by global changes in hydrological cycle and atmospheric circulation that do not necessarily depend in any detail on patterns of sea surface temperature change in the tropics. They can be influenced by the fact that the whole planet is just warming up. So these are maps of changes in precipitation minus evaporation. So that's the net flux of water at the surface of the Earth for the next two-decade period, 2021 to 2040, relative to the latter half of the 20th century, the winter half years and summer half years. This is the old climate model ensemble that was reported by IPCC in 2007, CMIP-3, and this is the new ensemble that will be reported on in the IPCC assessment report 5, which will come out probably next year or something. They're essentially very similar in their patterns, and you see the wet regions of the deep tropics and high latitudes are projected to get wetter again, while vast regions of the subtropics, which are already dry, are projected to get drier. And although you can't really see it there, the subtropical dry regions are also projected to expand poleward as well. Over North America, this is just a blow-up of that. This is the last decade's climate model simulations that are done. This is the new one. In both these cases, these are about climate model. It's an average of climate model simulations from about 20, 25 different climate modeling groups around the world. Multiple simulations by the different groups. It adds up to about 50 different climate model simulations. So for North America, you see in the latest ones, for the winter half year, you have a decline in net flux of water at the surface that extends all the way from the southwest across through Texas into the southeast, with wet in the northeast. And then in the summer half year, the drying is actually more over the northern part of the United States. In terms of, this is precipitation minus evaporation for three different regions, California and Nevada, the Colorado River headwaters, and Texas. And these are individual models. Each row is an individual model. You don't need to worry about that. And then these are two-decade periods. So this is 2021 to 2040, 2060 to 2080, out to 2080 to 2100. And you can every single individual model simulation is plotted here as either a black dot or a red dot. The black dot is the average of, or the red dot is the average of the individual model simulations for that model. But you can see, say, for California and Nevada or for the Colorado River headwaters, that they're overwhelmingly these model simulations are negative, and generally the case for Texas too. So by plotting it this way, you're actually also looking at the natural variability within the models, because each individual run has its ongoing natural variability. But the fact that as the century moves on, all of the individual model simulations are ending up on the negative side is just saying that the radiatively forced decline in water flux at the surface for these three regions is getting as large as the natural variability. So that in the next two-decade period or by the middle of the century, the radiatively driven drying within the Southwest will be of a equivalent amplitude to the multi-decadal natural variability that we know has occurred on the past and which will continue to occur. So the blow-up for this is for the Colorado River headwater. This is the change in runoff that the global climate models predict by season. Winter, it actually goes up slightly, which could well be because of increased snow melt or less snow in winter and more precipitation. And then a big drop in the spring runoff, which is what the reservoirs collect, 25% or something. This is the whole range of the models, and this is the mean of the models, and the box shows the line in the middle shows the median of the models in the 25th and 75th percentiles. And then here we have it in the annual mean. So in the annual mean, the mean and the median are about a 10%, are predicting about a 10% drop in Colorado River runoff for 2021 to 2040 relative to what it was in the latter half of the 20th century. And then there's a very long tree ring reconstruction by Dave Miko and others of Colorado River flow, where they found that during the 12th century drought, for about a two-decade period, the river flow was maybe about 15% less than it is now. So the radiatively induced change drop in runoff the models are predicting is equivalent to what has happened in the past, in past medieval mega droughts, except that the past medieval mega droughts only last for a decade or two. What the climate models are predicting is something which will happen forevermore, as long as the increased CO2 is in the atmosphere. It's not multi-decadal. It would be multi-decadal out to centuries as long as the CO2 stays in the atmosphere. 10% may not seem a lot, but the Colorado River is already over-allocated, so any drop is worrying. That was all based on climate model simulations. So can we actually say in any way that what the climate models projects should be happening is in fact happening? Well, we have tried to look at that, and the way that we've done that is to try to understand that the extent to which the mechanisms of climate change, hydroclimate change, are different from the mechanisms due to hydroclimate variability. So again, here is the projected change in P minus E with the subtropics drying and so on. This is the part of that that occurs simply because the atmospheric humidity goes up. If you increase the atmospheric humidity, water vapor transports in the atmosphere intensify, dry regions get drier, wet regions get wetter, and you can explain much of what happens just in terms of an increase in humidity. But this is the part of the change in P minus E that is caused by the fact that the atmospheric circulation changes. And you can see that this is, in many places, this is as important in magnitude as the change due to rising humidity. So the way the global warming, increase in greenhouse gases is causing P minus E to change is both due to a fact that the humidity goes up and also the fact that the atmospheric circulation is different when you pump the atmosphere full of carbon dioxide. That turns out to be quite different to the pattern to the mechanisms of natural variability of P minus E. This is the dominant mode of natural variability of P minus E is the El Niño-La Niña cycle, here plotted for model simulations of La Niña. Again, you have subtropical drying, but in this case, for natural variability, it's almost entirely dominated by changes in the atmospheric circulation, while changes in humidity aren't as important for this at all. So using that kind of approach, we took a atmospheric data set, a 3D representation of the atmosphere, so-called atmospheric reanalysis, and then we removed from that our best estimate of the changes in the hydrological cycle due to ENSO variability. We take that away, and then we look at the trend in what's left over. After you've removed the natural variability, what's left over should contain the climate change component. And then we compare that against, and the mechanisms that are responsible for it, against what the climate models say should have happened to date due to changes in radiative forcing. So this there, the dotted line here, is the 1979 to 2008 change in zonal mean P minus E that the climate models predict should have happened up to now due to changes in the radiative concentrations of gases in the atmosphere. You see the wetting at the equator, drying in the subtropics, wetting in higher latitudes. And then this is what you get, the solid line within an atmospheric reanalysis after removing what ENSO did over what El Niño Southern Oscillation did over the last several decades. And you can see that there is some degree of similarity between these, and then we can extend that by looking at what the physical mechanisms were that were responsible over the last few decades within the reanalysis, and you find a reasonable match that is suggestive that there is some evidence at the planetary scale that the hydrological cycle is indeed evolving the way the climate models predict it should be due to changes in CO2, methane, and ozone, etc. Regional attribution, however, would be much more difficult. So just to conclude, in the past, we've always had these droughts. We know in recent years, we now know that they're very related to tropical sea surface temperature anomalies. The Dust Bowl was a very unique drought in that it also, crop failure and dust storms, a human component, made that drought significantly worse and shifted it northward. Active dunes and dust also seem to have been important during the medieval mega droughts, but we need much better knowledge of what the oceans were doing at that time to really understand the full causes of those. The mechanisms whereby rising greenhouse gases influence hydroclimates are mechanistically quite different from the mechanisms of natural drought variability. And as time goes on, I think we're going to be able to use that to work out the relative degree of influence of the two processes on ongoing drought events. But the fact is that things do seem to be evolving the way that we would expect them to be, and if that is so, in key regions of the Southwest, such as California and Colorado headwaters, there will be a notable and appreciable reduction in runoff and soil moisture within the near-term future, the next two decades or so. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to move on, but stick around and we'll have time. If you have questions for Richard, we'll address those. At this point, I think what we're going to do is have a summary from our discussant, Kathy Jacobs. Kathy is the Assistant Director of Climate Adaptation and Assessment, part of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. So she's going to take on the noble task of summarizing what we've heard here this morning. So, Kathy. Do you want to put something in?
I think I'm not going to.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Can I shut it, though? Or
you can.
It?
Sure. So, we'll stick on there. Water.
Okay. Thanks, Connie, and thanks to all of you. I think this has been a great session. And my job has been to try to summarize some of the themes that we heard and maybe integrate them a bit for all of you. First of all, I wanted to start by saying how glad I am that we're past talking only about the uncertainties, about what it is that we're observing. In fact, there's a lot of observations and evidence coming from so many different perspectives that it's actually a bit overwhelming. We know a lot, and we're getting a lot better at communicating those things, and certainly the people that we heard from this morning are all good communicators, and that's actually, it's wonderful to be in a session where things are made so clear. It's also evident that the things are changing. We are entering what may soon be called the Anthropocene. We are observing through many mechanisms, changes in the natural environment, and the mechanisms that cause those changes are being identified. I think one thing that was quite impressive about this session was the looking at this from so many different disciplinary perspectives, looking at it from multiple scales and multiple time frames. I think putting it in a historical context is really important, taking the paleo perspective and then comparing the observations that we're now collecting today. I think the issue of thresholds really came out quite a bit. We were talking about not only the thresholds associated with the ecosystems and individual species, but also historic cultures. And clearly, the kinds of thresholds that we're crossing today having to do with the capacity of our own infrastructure to deal with the change that is happening, especially as the rate of change increases. So I think there's a lot of power in integrating all these different sources of historical and current observations, whether it's tree rings or coral or sea surface temperatures, precipitation, all kinds of different data sets that are now able to be integrated through really sophisticated modeling and really sophisticated thought processes. So I have some questions about what we heard as well. First of all, to what degree are we already seeing the future, or are we really just on the edge of the new abnormal? In other words, are we already seeing a lot of the trends that we are likely to see in the future, or, in fact, are we just at the edge of all of that? Another question has to do with my own personal interest in drought, which is I do find it very interesting that even though the temperature increases across are very, very robust across the entire country, with the exception of the Southeast, that we are not seeing national trends in drought on the long term. Obviously, Don showed us a picture of drought trends over different parts of the last century. But that the overall trend in drought, probably because of the influence of the 1930s drought, is not yet as evident. We are making enormous progress with attribution. There's a lot of new news about what components of what we're observing can be attributed to things that are expected in the context of climate change. But we are really just on the edge of all of that, and starting to parse things out the way Richard did is very helpful. Understanding what it is that we can document about mechanisms in particular. It is also really important to be thinking about how our own decisions are feeding back into these extreme events. I mean, we are all aware, I think, that our land use decisions have a lot to do with how expensive many of these events have been in terms of where we actually build very costly infrastructure and things like that. But the idea that, you know, our farming practices are actually potentially causing drought, or that the feedback mechanisms from land surface interactions with the atmosphere are really not well enough understood, and that many of the things that we're making decisions about today, we may not completely understand the long-term impacts. So I'm just going to briefly hit a few more themes. I've used about 5 minutes, I think. A few more themes of sort of what I heard this morning. I put them in categories, sort of categories called evidence, impacts, prediction, attribution, perceptions, and policy implications. As far as the evidence goes, we have a long list of things we're observing now: more extreme temperatures over time, an increase in heat records, a decrease in cold records, more drought, at least in recent years, very intense record-breaking droughts in certain parts of the country, the number of billion-dollar events increasing, hurricane intensity increasing, record ice melt, global annual records, national annual records, you know, having to add new colors to maps, et cetera. So there's a lot of multiple different ways of documenting what we're observing and showing that it's different than what has happened in the past. We've got new ways of comparing across a much broader past, meaning we are putting in context today's observations against this very long tree ring record created by some of my personal heroes, including Connie Woodhouse. This idea that many of these impacts are really, we're seeing an incremental change coming in from the climate change signal on top of variability. So obviously, variability has been going on for a long time. We all understand that. The question is how much of what we're observing today is coming from these new drivers that are operating in concert with natural variability. Going to the impact side, I think that the Texas drought is an excellent example. In fact, it's one that we concentrated on quite a lot in the National Climate Assessment. One of the things that makes it a good example of impacts is all the cascading effects. There's a lot going on there with an increase in temperature, a rapid onset of dryness, impacts on electricity and on water supply and on energy production, and a wide variety of forest and agricultural productivity. It's great to actually have the economic data associated with that. I think all of the documentation now of changes in species is just completely overwhelming. The magnitude of the data in terms of the number of species, the percentage that are changing in terms of both their distribution and their phenology, all the incredible details associated with adaptive capacity, and looking at very small scales as well as looking at very broad ecosystem scales, and starting to really understand the mechanisms. I mean, it's amazing to think we can take this down to the microclimate of an individual plant, and then we can also think about these impacts and this evidence across ecosystems that are shifting northward and into higher elevation. Moving into the prediction area, which is, I think, where many managers wish we were in better shape. If we can identify the mechanisms of drought, we should be in a better position to predict it. But drought is a really complicated phenomenon. First of all, it's partially in the eye of the beholder. It's defined differently for different kinds of users. And, you know, some people see drought only as absence of precipitation, and other people see it as soil moisture, and some people define it in terms of reservoir levels and so forth. But drought is a really tricky thing. It's a slow onset extreme event. You can't tell which day it started, really. How do you predict the duration, the intensity, the onset, and the end of droughts, all of which are critical from a water management perspective? And so we are so far away from getting to something truly that you can get your arms around with all of those categories. There clearly are physical limits to predictability. You know, we will probably never understand every component of what's going on with atmospheric circulation and drivers. So this idea of distinguishing natural variability from change and being able to parse the pieces out is very powerful, but I don't think we'll ever have full predictive capacity. It is very interesting to be thinking about this in multiple time frames, multi-decadal, individual seasons, et cetera. So the time frames of drought are really critical. Moving to attribution, I mentioned I think we are very at the sort of edge of a brave new world with attribution. A lot of it is statistics. It's really about probabilities. How probable or likely is it that a particular event could occur or a string of events could occur with and without climate change, looking at this longer and longer historical context that we've got? This idea of attribution is really about how probable is it, or what are the odds of a particular thing happening if we didn't have these background changes in temperature and humidity in the atmosphere and so forth. I think it is important to note how different the mechanisms of natural variability are from the mechanisms of global change, and that really will help us with attribution, maybe even get beyond looking at this from a purely statistical perspective. I really appreciated the comments about the media coverage, and it's very clear that things are changing in terms of the American public's perceptions, and it's not just how they are personally experiencing these things, it's really how they're experiencing them through the mass media. And I think there has been a shift in terms of science getting better integrated into media coverage, though obviously maybe it's gone too far in some cases, where people who really are just communications experts sort of posing as scientists and adding their own layer of interpretation, because that helps make for a better story. This idea that all weather is now suspicious is an interesting concept. We can't just have a snowstorm anymore. We have to have something that is an unusual event. And that really helps, you know, get people to watch television. So that's sort of part of the deal now. Let's see. I guess I'll end with policy, and then we can sort of move from here. It is really important to think about, in this changing world, what the policy incentives are that we're setting up for human behavior, whether it's the flood insurance program, which essentially subsidizes having people live in areas that are relatively risky, and having the rest of the American public actually pay for that. As well as crop insurance and other kinds of programs that actually provide incentives not to use predictions, as we heard. this idea that many of our institutions are not particularly well suited for a changing environment. They're based on, you know, sort of a view of a stationary climate, and the water rights system in Texas, which was used as an example, is a great example, but almost every state has water rights systems that are not particularly flexible. You lay over that the federal water rights systems and all the historical context and policies and regulations. We have a relatively inflexible institutional structure to deal with all of this. And I thought that the note about what Mexico might look like in the future is worth noting. In particular, I haven't seen a map of the future of Mexico that didn't have brown all over it. And if I were in Mexico, I would be very alarmed. I live in Arizona, so I'm pretty alarmed. But Mexico is even more of concern, I would say, and that has lots of implications for us. So lots of policy implications associated with the drivers of change and the need to be adapted to change. And we're currently working on adaptation pretty hard in Washington right now, which I'm very happy to be part of. But I think we have a long way to go. So,
all right,
a lot of stuff. Yes.
So we do have time for a little bit of questions and discussions, especially for Camille and for David, for Richard, who we didn't have time for, but for anybody else who has questions of any of our speakers or of our discussant, Kathy Jacobs, open the floor. And as you address your question, let me know who you're addressing it to. We'll have that person come up. Gentleman in the back. Where's the water going? Who is that directed to? Which of our speakers would like to address that?
The question is about the Ogallala Aquifer and how that will be affecting agriculture now and in the future. Ogallala Aquifer is a major aquifer that runs from Nebraska on down to Texas. As a general rule, the farther south you go, the smaller the recharge rate. So in Nebraska, it's a resource that's renewable and is plentiful. In Texas, it is being depleted. And has experienced declines of around 30 to 50 feet in places in terms of the height of the aquifer. Projections for its future have it essentially being unavailable in different places as we go forward in 2 decades, 3 decades, 5 decades, and so forth. Because it's actually, If you're to try to use it as a sustainable rate, you'd be able to irrigate perhaps 1/20th of the agriculture that's presently being irrigated. So it's actually viewed as a non-renewable resource and is being mined effectively to produce food. And that's going to go on as long as there's water available, and then the amount of farming is gradually going to decline over time. And if that happens, unless there's replacement of an industrial-based economy or something like that, the population of the panhandle of Texas will decline as well, and it'll transition to largely ranching, whereas right now there's a large part of the panhandle that's irrigated. If the groundwater is not being controlled by some sort of management district, you have the right to do that. The management plan has to be in some sense equitable in order for the management district not to have to pay compensation. Although the court did not define what equitable meant, so there's definitely an opening there for water rights lawyers to fill the gap.
Yes.
What a great question. Because what I want to emphasize is that we do have conservation solutions, even though there's uncertainty in the climate predictions, even though there's uncertainty in exactly what climate events are affecting species. Because one thing that's really obvious is, as you're seeing species move around the globe, this is already happening, is that our preserve network isn't designed to deal with this. It's designed to deal with stability. And so what people are doing are, connectivity has always been important in conservation, but what people are trying to focus on now is connectivity with latitude and connectivity with altitude. So instead of just sort of general connectivity, they're really trying to connect preserves that have elevational gradients, preserves that have latitudinal gradients, and in designing new preserves, building that in. Some of the more radical notions that people are not just talking about but doing is actually helping species move. Because, what I was showing you is kind of in the absence of human development, this is what's happening. But in most areas, species have barriers to that kind of movement, either agricultural land or urban areas. And in the USA, this idea is fairly controversial amongst conservation biologists, because people have been working with invasive species for the last, their whole lives. And they're very worried about causing an invasive species by moving an exotic out of its historic range, which is what we're talking about, into a new area where the climate space is becoming suitable. The interesting thing is they're already doing it in Europe, where they're much more used to heavily managed systems. So they've already moved four butterflies in England, scooping them up, taking them across an agricultural landscape to the next good habitat. The populations are doing great. They're growing. They've been there for several years. They're building up. They're not doing any harm to the native community. They've moved a fish from lakes in northern England up into Scotland. I don't know if there's been an impact statement on that one yet. But what I'm noticing over the 10 years I've been advocating this is that American conservation biologists are now starting to consider it. And it's because people are seeing that the stability idea just isn't working. I mean, they're seeing their own species they've loved and cared about for 30 years disappearing. So that's one solution that I think is not going to be good for biodiversity in general, but it could be really important for key species that society and for scientific reasons are very important. The other thing that we can do is actually restoration. We're quite good at restoring a lot of different systems, wetland systems, vernal pool systems, prairie systems. We've been very, very successful in restoration. And so the idea is, well, perhaps you can recreate habitat that was there before that can allow stepping stones to allow species to move on their own. So it's not quite as radical. The idea is that you're simply creating those stepping stones to allow the passive movement of species. And that, what's nice about that idea is the real limitation is labor. It's not really costly if you've got people to do it. And so when I give talks about this to community groups, they get really excited because they see this as something they can get the community involved in. Little kids can do it. High schools can do it. And again, the big cost is labor. So if you have people volunteering the time, you can actually do some quite good large restoration projects. So a third thing I want to mention, which is it's sort of related to the assisted colonization, but it's not quite as dramatic. It's the idea of, it's called genetic rescue. It's the idea of, can you help populations in situ adapt to climate change by, part of it is mutations, but in terms of conservation, it's bringing in new genes. So from the same species, the idea is if natural dispersal is being impeded, which it is, perhaps some populations might be okay if you could just allow gene flow. And so bringing in bringing in individuals from populations adapted to a more extreme climate into your population. So again, this is not bringing them outside the historic range. It's not bringing in a new species. It's just helping the genes move around. And that, I think, will be very, very important at a local level. It's becoming very clear with both observational data and modeling data that this isn't going to save species from going extinct. The polar bear is not going to be saved by doing this. But if you do have particular preserve areas that you want to maintain a particular set of species in, by bringing in individuals from other more extreme adapted populations, you might be able to help those adapt in situ. And we certainly are seeing real-time evolution to climate change. So just in the last 10 or 15 years, we are seeing genetic changes in population, adapting them to the climate change that they have been experiencing.
Right. I think we might have time for one more question.
There's a whole range of answers to that. First of all, it's all about risk management. And it's clear that the evidence in the science community is so strong that we are seeing something, you know, that climate change is happening, it's happening rapidly, and that it is largely happening because of human activities, that we should be very concerned. Then if you do risk management on top of that to say, well, what might this mean to the future and what kind of planning we should do, it's clear that we should be both doing mitigation and adaptation. No matter what we do in mitigation, we're not going to fully stop the changes. So we need to be very carefully looking at adaptation in a variety of different sectors and parts of the country. But you know, hopefully we can mitigate to avoid the worst of the changes as well.
Anybody else have something to add to that on a happy note? we're sort of over time, but if people want to stay, I think we can still take questions.
I guess it depends what it says. I don't really anticipate it saying it much with such greater certainty than AR4, that it may actually be treated a little bit like what SREX was, the special report that the IPCC put out on extreme events. And that sort of just didn't make waves in the media. There was just so much that had already been reported that wasn't new. So it could go many different ways, but I kind of think that it's going to be different than AR4, which really elevated the issue and led to so many stories. And I think this time it may sort of just be another confirmation of what we have been seeing and saying and reporting on before. That's just a hunch.
Any more questions? It looks like we're losing the audience. So thanks to the speakers very much, and thank you for listening.